Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio. And of course, the most important question of the day for me is, am I broadcasting? So let me ask Gene, am I broadcasting?
Yes, you are.
Oh, my God, thank God.
Loud and clear. Yeah.
It is so funny. You know, thank God the creek don't rise, and I'll knock on wood and all the other things I can do that, you know, when one of us has a problem, the other one doesn't. So we seem to be.
Thank goodness, yeah.
We seem to be covering all the bases here in the appropriate way. So at least most of the technology that needs to work most of the time, and that's why I had to call in yesterday. So that early gap of a few seconds is the fact that I just simply wasn't broadcasting. I mean, I thought I was. You know, but I don't know. So I've written the folks that the engineers, the people that create all this Blog Talk, you know, wonderful technology, to put in a gauge, a levels, you know, like they have in the producer studios. If you ever see the either pictures or videos of studios, they have these little gauges that go back. There's usually two of them, right? And they go. They have a green light area, which is where you want to operate. You have a yellow area, which is kind of danger, and then you have the red area. You don't want to be in the red area because you're just breaking up and it's going to sound horrible. And so my Adobe Audition, and the one I use to create the commercials and all the spots that I make on the show, that has levels too. And so I know it can be done because they do it. So it's very simple. So what we need to do is have the same thing here, have some kind of a level in the studio to be able to see exactly, you know, when we're broadcasting, when we're not. I mean, that would be a huge help. So I'm working on that. I'm working on some other things too. That'd be just, you know, fabulous. But apparently there's a new feature too, which I'm not even sure where it is on our studio yet. But apparently the listeners, the callers, when they call in, if they have a microphone or headset, they'll be able to direct connect automatically. And so I'm just started reading about this. I'm not sure where it is on our board here, because we have the most of the things on the board. I know what they do because I've tried them. One way or another, I find out what they do. Live chat, you know, I played with that for a while until I figured out that this actually was a live chat thing. It's like, oh, people are going to appear on there and they're going to talk to us. Have we had any live chats lately? I don't think we've. Bumberjack seems to be our perennial live chat person.
Nobody making comments.
Yeah. Well, I should probably mention it more often, too. All right, so live chat. Anybody that listens to us live, you podcast folks, you can't do it, obviously, because the shows are already done. So, you know, I love you listening to the podcast, but I would encourage you, if you can, to at least occasionally or whenever you can, listen to a show live, because that's where the action is. That's where you can call in. And if you don't want to call in, you can type it. And so live chat is pretty easy. You just find where on the page, I think it's on the top left corner somewhere, where it says to open a free Blog Talk Radio account. And once you get that, then you can join live chat, just like Bumblejack. And especially if you disagree with me and you don't feel that you can talk to me on the show or Gene on the show, then you can certainly type in your angst, which is fine with me. But disagreeing, again, is no problem. Listen to Gene. I mean, Gene disagrees with me all the time. It's you know, it's kind of cool. So that's a regular feature here, so that's not a problem. Today's kind of catch-up day. We're going to be off tomorrow. But it suddenly occurred to me last night, I don't want to be off for 4 days in a row. To me, that's no fun. So what I'm going to do for Friday is make it an optional day for all of our reporters, and that includes Eugene. If you want to call in, call in. If you don't want to call in, that's okay too. But I'm going to – there's a lot of philosophical big issue articles I haven't had a chance to get to. And I think that might be a good time to try it out and just see if anybody, you know, the regular reporters, if they're off, want to talk to other reporters, people want to call in, you know, you want to ask whatever question you want, you know, about Action Radio, about what we do here. All that's going to be fair game. And so that would be a fun time to do that as well. Gene, do you have any stories? I've got a few little things here before David Jones gets here at 7, and then our special guest, Dave Schneier. Dave Schneier has been on the show, I think the first time he was about 14 years old, and so he's probably like 16 or 17 now. I'm not sure which. We'll find out when he gets here. Young reporter, does his own videos. He's good, and I'd like to get him back here on a regular basis as an education reporter. He's homeschooled. He's just a really bright kid. And, I feel a lot better with the future in the hands of someone like Dave Schneier than a lot of the folks coming out of government education. But back to the question I asked Eugene, anything particular, stories that you've been upset about? What's going on?
Well, first, I just want to wish people a happy Thanksgiving tomorrow, because sometimes at the end of the show, it's, you know, it's the end of the show gets here pretty fast. So just say happy Thanksgiving. I will be working, so hopefully those of you that are working, I'm right there with you. And have a good one. Have a safe one. If you're home by yourself or with family, yes, just enjoy. You know, it's just interesting. There's so much stuff going on. And my big thing is nothing in particular. It's just that still trying to wade through, you know, what's true, what's false, you know, and some I have no idea. But no, there's nothing in particular right now that I want to talk
about. Well, let's
try
them. If you have a couple of true or false or the things you might have a question of, let's do what we do best, which is, you know, apply logic and reason and see if we can cut through the BS. And see if we can, you know, come to some kind of, you know, finding on what you might be thinking about. Any issue in particular? You don't have
no,
to.
My big thing is always, you know, is something going to happen that Trump gets back sooner? Is Kamala, are they really getting rid of her as vice president? And God forbid, no, don't recommend her for the Supreme Court.
What?
And then, you know,
she'd have to be able to form a coherent argument and somehow, you know, be able to make a cogent, logical presentation. I don't think she's capable of doing that, quite frankly, given the evidence of everything I've seen for her. I mean, she's a lawyer. You know, I don't think she's ever been a judge. And they seem to like that now. But the funny thing about the Supreme Court is you don't even have to be a lawyer to be on the Supreme Court. There's no requirement for that. So I want to be the first. In fact, some of the Supreme Court justices were not lawyers. It's really quite fascinating. You know, not only were they not judges, they weren't even lawyers. I would like to be the first lawyer in over 100 years, the first non-lawyer in over 100 years to be on the Supreme Court. That would be cool. I would try for it just to do the confirmation hearing, which I think if I got a chance to do that would be hysterical, because I would bring up things that none of these folks even dare talk about, like the fact that judicial review is unconstitutional, that the court can't make policy, can't make regulations. All they can do is issue opinions, you know, that they only directly affect the participants in the case, the parties to the case. That's it. And that's where the jurisdiction ends. And after that, you know, it's up to the legislature and the executive to make a resolution based on the court's opinion. That alone it would probably disqualify me, but would create enough controversy to send the Supreme Court into a tizzy, as they say. Especially if I actually got on the Supreme Court, because I'd say exactly what I felt like. I wouldn't kowtow to their order and seniority and protocols and all that kind of nonsense. I wouldn't bother with any of that stuff. A, I wouldn't have time, and B, I wouldn't do it anyway. But yeah, Supreme Court. What do you think?
No,
I don't even know
that
how I
would
got
be
to
good.
That.
You know. The thing is, sometimes I think they should have more people on there that are not lawyers or have that training, because it's just ridiculous. You know, some of the I guess maybe it's just politics in general. Once they get on there, then politics takes over and their common sense goes out the window.
Well, when you think about it, you know, it makes sense for a judge to be a lawyer, you know, if you're in a criminal case, because you really want to understand the criminal law. And criminal law is pretty complex. I mean, you look at and even as good as I thought the judge was in the Kyle Rittenhouse case, and we'll talk about that in the third hour, he still made some mistakes. And those were non-lawyer mistakes, like not sequestering the jury was huge, because, of course, they're listening to the protests outside. They're going home. They're getting threatened. They're getting all kinds of horrible things happening. You know, they had that MSNBC producer follow the jury bus home. Yeah, they blocked them from the trial, but, you know, there's still the intimidation factor is there. It's just, you know, Kyle's good fortune. He had a jury of, you know, honest people who were able to make a decision. But the judge screwed up there big time. Screwed up in a couple of other places. Probably could have declared a mistrial at several points in the trial based on the prosecutorial misconduct and the withholding of evidence. I mean, I'm glad it went to a jury verdict and they found the way they did. But, you know, if they found differently, then grounds for mistrial, you know, would have been grounds for appeal. And so there's a lot of what ifs, you know, involved with this. But some of the things the judge did made absolutely no sense to me whatsoever, the big one being not sequestering the jury. Yeah. Anyway, you're still there. I hope you're still there.
I am.
Still there.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
good.
I'm,
just checking
I,
in.
I'm still. You know, I'm still
we
trying
think.
To log into my computer, because
okay.
It lets me log into the program, but it doesn't let me log into the site, but I can't get on the the program today because it keeps giving me the other options. And from when I logged in earlier today and I got kicked out, it continues. But no.
Oh, yeah. So it's your day for computer glitches. Yeah.
Yes, yes. So it's just interesting. I don't know if you watched the, what's his name, Tucker Carlson interview. I listened to a little bit of it. Some other talk people I've been listening to recently, they were all like, you need to listen to it. You need to listen to it. Mm-hmm. I don't know. There's some things that I don't even know if they know the real truth, because I follow Lynn Wood pretty closely. And according to what Lynn Wood is saying and what they're saying are two different things. And yes, Lynn Wood is a lawyer, but I think there was a lot of stuff going on that people were just unaware of. And anyway, that's that. But I'm glad.
Well, we can save that for our talk with Dave in the third hour, Dave Schneier, who put out a video on it. I posted a video. I also posted the Tucker Carlson video as well with the Kyle Rittenhouse interview. I haven't heard the whole thing. I just hit upon it by accident because I just happened to follow Dave's video. And Tucker, of course, has a few more views, but, Dave will catch up one day. But it's interesting just to listen to Kyle, who sounds very intelligent, very straightforward. But also you can tell where he's using, lawyerly language, in terms of, did you feel your life was threatened? Yes, I felt my life was threatened,
yes,
I thought,
so well.
Oh, yeah. But in actual, that's what lawyers are supposed to do. And he should use that language. It's obvious that he has been coached, the truth is he has to use that language. Otherwise he sets himself up for, further trials or civil lawsuits or God knows what Brandon's insurrection will do. Yeah.
He's still going to be tried for the wrongful death of the other people. And he should not have to pay a dime to those families, because bottom line is those people were, granted, it's too bad they were killed, but the thing is, none of those three that were shot were law-abiding citizens at that time, on that night. You know what I mean? And it's just crazy. And the thing is, what gets me, it's like, on January 6th, the guy that had the Vikings outfit on. Whatever.
Yeah, because they call him QAnon for some reason. Yeah.
But he's getting 4 years in prison for what did he do compared to what did the rioters do with they burned down cities when they killed those? Anybody? Is anybody being charged when the George Floyd stuff was going on?
These are political prisoners. We've entered the world of political prisoners, where people are judged by what the agenda wants, not what justice requires. That's the problem.
Yes, and that he was in solitary confinement for I don't know how many, almost a year. That can't be a year because it's not been a year since then. I forget how many days. It was some ungodly amount of days. Why did they put someone in solitary confinement what did he do to be a threat?
Well, that's illegal. You can't put someone in solitary confinement unless they're convicted. He wasn't convicted of a crime. Solitary confinement in many ways is considered a torture, and it's reserved for the worst people in prison who commit crimes in prison. Okay. You don't automatically go into solitary confinement. That's for the worst prisoners in prison, who then commit further crimes in prison. That's who goes into solitary, because it's the only place you can put them to protect the other prisoners. That's what solitary is all about. Solitary is not for the person who did stuff. It's for the other people. Just like immigration is for Americans, it's not for the immigrants. People forget what all this stuff is all about. So it's crazy what's going on. But we have entered this very strange world of political prisoners. That's why George, Paul Manafort, Roger Stone, George Papadopoulos, these people were prosecuted for political reasons. Trump supporters are being hunted down like dogs, I saw in one video. In fact, it's the new video coming out, Capital Punishment. Capital spelled C-A-P-I-T-O-L. In other words, the Capitol building. They're hunting Trump supporters. Trump supporters are being prosecuted for being Trump supporters. That's a political, thing. That's not a judicial process. That's not a criminal process. That is a political process. And that's what's going on. As soon as you get away from the Constitution, as soon as you let dictatorships into the White House, everything stems from letting Brandon, into the White House illegally. And the biggest person responsible for that is Mike Pence. and then the other geldings. Those are the people that put them in because they could have stopped them when the states had two. We're going to get to what can be done about the election. I've got an article on that. But the thing is, the question of when could this have been stopped? Well, it could have been stopped after the election by being declared a fraud and having the judges who were supposed to take up the case, especially in the Supreme Court, take up the case. That was one case. Mike Pence had a couple of opportunities to send electors back when he got two slates. When the state legislature sent Trump electors in, the lawful ones, and the state governors and the secretaries of state, the corrupt people, sent in these false Biden electors, and Pence took the Biden electors, rather than send them both back and say, look, you folks need to decertify and start over and figure out what you're doing. That's what he could have done, should have done, and then, of course, Trump would have been elected, or at least we would have been in this limbo position for a while until they figured out the thing. See, the audit should have happened, after the decertification, not before. Because votes have to prove themselves before they're accepted. They don't have to be accepted, then prove themselves. See, everybody's doing this backwards. So they should have been decertified, before the Arizona legislature should have decertified before the audit. And they said, okay, let's find out, what the real story is here, whether we can actually certify this election. That's what they should have done, but they didn't. Anyway, we're kind of rambling here. I want to get to this one article before we too far into the show, celebrating the 400th anniversary of Thanksgiving. But anyway, back to you. We're sort of... Go ahead.
Yeah. I just got one more question, and I don't understand this, but he's going into the reserves of what fuel or whatever that is, and it's like, okay, that makes no sense, because I was listening to something yesterday, and they said you never tap into that unless you're in a war, and so he's doing that for what? And then if something does happen, because it's only a matter of time because of his incompetency, and so then it's like, then what are we going to do? Because he closed down the pipeline, and it's so interesting for them to come up with why gas is the price it is and all this stuff. It's like, it's not consumer usage and all this crap. It's like, are they kidding me? I just wish once they'd have one person on anywhere involved with them. That would be honest.
Well, I mean, think about it. Their whole administration is a lie. They're not in power. They weren't elected. Everybody knows it, especially the Democrats, because they're the ones that stole the election. So the idea that Democrats don't know they're lying and don't know they're holding power illegally is absurd. Of course they know. So once you get to the point where you can commit a coup, where you can overthrow a legitimate government, a legitimate Trump administration, lying about everything else is like a serial killer. After the first, few killings, it gets easy. After the lies of stealing the White House, and then justifying it in the media and the media supporting it, the lies just keep getting easier. So it's easy for them to say, well, it's consumer demand driving the price of oil. But let's what you're talking about is the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, the SPR. And what it is an emergency contingency, generally for wartime, you're absolutely right, but it's for real emergencies when there's no other way to get energy, no other way to get oil. We have this reserve of oil that can be put into circulation very quickly, if like there's a massive embargo from OPEC and things like that, back when we were dependent on foreign oil, which we are now again. And so it's only to be used for emergencies. It doesn't have to be a war, but a war would be one of the most likely times, because otherwise, why would you do that? Unless it was a massive natural disaster that destroyed the pipelines, for example, or a snowstorm so bad oil trucks couldn't get on the road for a month, so that kind of a thing might cause the release of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Now, the beauty of it was that Trump, when oil prices were really, really low, he said, let's buy a whole bunch and fill them up. And of course, his Twitter advisor said, no, that's a stupid idea. And of course, Trump was right. Fortunately, he went with his gut instincts. When he went with his instincts, he was good. When he listened to other people like Dr. Fascist, he completely screwed up. So he bought oil really cheaply. He filled all the tanks of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve for an emergency with really cheap oil. So Brandon is now capitalizing on Trump's wisdom yet again in releasing it. But the problem is, what he's releasing amounts to about 3 days' supply of oil, which is really a drop in the bucket. The idea of lowering the price 15, 20, maybe even 25 cents a gallon for a short period of time is, as Joe mentioned, said, a Band-Aid on cancer. So the real problem is they've shut off the energy. They've shut off the supply. That's why the prices are up. The demand really hasn't changed that much. Yes, there was less demand during the time the government was artificially locking us up. Of course there was. People couldn't go anywhere, and there's nowhere to go. You couldn't go to work. You know, you couldn't go buy things unless you went to a major contributor to the political campaigns like Walmart and Target and some of the other big stores, the big grocery stores and things like that. But you couldn't go to the mom and pop stores, and you couldn't go to the local restaurants. There's no place to go. So, of course, gasoline demand was down, which, of course, lowered the price artificially. But back in the heyday of the Trump economy, when things were going well, there was a huge demand for fuel and economy of scale. The more you sell, the lower the price. Okay, if you sell a whole bunch of stuff, you can reduce the price per unit. If all of a sudden, you know, somebody's shoes became the most popular shoes in the world, you know, New Balance, my favorite shoes. All of a sudden, New Balance comes out with a brand new shoe. It's so popular, you know, they can sell it at a higher price. But eventually they realize, well, we can sell this at a lower price and make more money. Okay, so set a lower price, more and more people buy, shoe X, and then they actually make more profit by lowering it. So the oil companies found that out too. So economics, basic economics, you know, price has a direct relationship to profit. If you price something too highly, you know, people aren't going to buy it because they can't afford it. If you price something too low, they probably think it's too cheap and it doesn't have any value. So you kind of find a price somewhere in the middle where people, you know, think they're getting a value, but they still think they're getting a bargain. And so for oil, it became a thing where, you know, around or just under $2 is like a price that people can afford. It's not a hardship. They can fill the tank. They can go places and they can do stuff, you know, but it's not so cheap that people are just buying it frivolously and, you know, stockpiling it and doing all kinds of other crazy things. So, you know, around $2 a gallon seems to work these days. It's probably the equivalent of the 25 cents it was in the early 1970s when I showed up in this country. Okay, so.
Hey, I got one more question.
I got time for this. This is a good issue. Yeah.
You're not moving to Jupiter, are you?
Not in the near future, no. Do they have internet?
Oh, I figured.
Can I broadcast my show?
Isn't it Jupiter, Florida? Jupiter, Florida?
Oh.
Yeah. I figured you were going to since Nancy Pelosi's buying a house there.
Nancy Pelosi's buying a house in Jupiter, Florida. Listen, I lived in the same town when she did in I was across the bay, but I lived in San Francisco and Nancy lived in San Francisco. Quite frankly, we're never going to be neighbors. I mean, she's in the hoity-toity neighborhood. You know, she's where the rich folks live. You know, so, yeah, in fact, I think when I was a tour guide in San Francisco, I think I went by near her house. I don't think I went exactly by her house, but I certainly was near it. But I went by, who's the woman that did the romance novels that made just millions and millions of dollars? She has a house in Paris and a house in San Francisco.
Was it Danielle Steele?
Danielle Steele, right. So Danielle Steele, that's whose house I used to go by. So we go by Danielle Steele's house. And, of course, they've got, like, you know, 20-foot hedges, you know, a five-story building and, you know, all kinds of stuff like that. She has a mansion. It's, like, all marble on the outside. It's a beautiful house, right? And she's got one in Paris, too. But, yeah, so there's some really rich folks. Dianne Feinstein lives in San Francisco. We knew where her house was. You could tell because there were security outside the gated community 24 hours a day. So, you know, her house is pretty well guarded. So there's a lot of rich folks in San Francisco. I lived near the Haight when I was in the city, and then I lived across the bay, you know, when I was teaching flying and doing stuff. But, it was very, it was fun until the 90s. And, of course, I got out, you know, I had a kid to raise, but after that I left. And it was just, it was such a mess. But when I got there in the 80s, it was fun. It was beautiful. It wasn't crowded. It had half the population California has now. And, of course, you know, too many people, especially illegals, you know, ruin stuff. Let's get back to oil for a second, because the point I wanted to ultimately make with this is the fact that Brandon and the insurrection, they've cut the Keystone pipeline. They want to cut other pipelines. They've stopped new leases on federal land for oil. And see, leases are temporary. That's why they keep having to have new ones. So as leases end, they have to renew them and get new leases. Well, they're not issuing new leases. So they are cutting the supply. They've cut the truckers in California because they won't let them be independent contractors. And they have ridiculous pollution rules so strict no independent trucker can meet them. So the independent truckers are being screwed. So that's where your supply chain problems are. And the tankers, of course, can't deliver. You know, the independent tanker trucks can't deliver it. And the pipelines are being shut down too. So the entire problem with oil is supply. I'll tell you right now, it's supply. And of course, OPEC looks at this and goes, whoa, this is great. If we restrict our supply too, Americans are screwed and they'll pay through the nose to get their oil. And of course, that's what happened. When Trump was in office, oil was about $40 a barrel. All right. Now it's about 80 heading for 120. All right. And it's purely a supply problem. See, when Trump was in office, we were energy independent. We didn't need OPEC. So the only way OPEC could sell oil to us was to undercut our price and sell even lower than we were. And at $35 a barrel, they lose money. So they don't want to do that. Right? But they did it because to get at least some money coming in. So at that point, we would slow down our production because we didn't have to. We'd use their production, buy their cheaper oil, but their cheaper oil was forced by our production because we didn't need their oil. Now we need their oil because we don't have our production. So not only is our oil not being produced and not being supplied and not being sent in pipelines and not being sent by truck and not being sent to stations where it can be distributed, and people can just buy their oil, it's being restricted. So, of course, the price is going up because the demand's pretty much the same. So it's not the demand that's changed. The Brandon insurrection is lying. It's the supply. And since they've cut the supply and made us dependent on foreigners who have also cut the supply is cut. And the first thing that happens when the supply is cut is the price goes up. Does that explain it pretty much?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
That's a good question. Yeah. In fact, let me play my Biden warning before the election. I'm going to get into this is the 400th anniversary of Thanksgiving, by the way. Most people don't know that. And so let me just find my little piece here, and I'll pull up this article, and we shall continue.
Joe Biden's dark winter. No freedom, no liberty, no guns, no representation, no oil, no coal, no nuclear power, no space force. No constitution, no family gatherings, no vacations, just taxes, work, misery, masks, lockdowns, and ever more government. This is what will happen if you let Marxists steal the election. This has been a public service announcement of Action Radio, reminding you it's time to get off your butt and save your country.
Was there a little break in there for a second? I think I heard, or maybe it was something I moved here on my microphone. I have to listen to the podcast. It sounded like it hesitated for just a second.
Yeah, there was a little break.
Yeah, I wonder sometimes of these recordings where they have to re-record them after so many plays. Anyway, I found an article, Intellectual Takeout, one of my favorite news sources, Jeff Minnick, M-I-N-I-C-K. And this is November 23rd. So is this yesterday? It's today, 24th. So yesterday, yeah. Celebrating the 400th anniversary of Thanksgiving. I didn't know it was the 400th anniversary. One would think in a country that created Thanksgiving that the fact that it's the 400th Thanksgiving would make this a really big deal. But apparently not, because we don't celebrate things like we're used to. And it's probably because it's pretty much a Christian holiday. it was started by Christians. And so therefore it probably means that the leftists, don't want to remind people that it was a Christian holiday because, either they want to celebrate it through cultural appropriation. So here's a question for you. If you're a leftist atheist and you're celebrating Thanksgiving, which is basically a Christian original holiday, is that cultural appropriation? Let me throw that sarcastic question out there. What do you think, Gene?
Yeah,
that was, and leftists, you can celebrate Thanksgiving. It's okay. It is the one American holiday, for everybody. There's no, everybody can celebrate Thanksgiving. I just want you leftists to know that if you're celebrating a Christian holiday, you're celebrating a Christian holiday. So there. All right.
Well, the thing is, it's not just some of them hate America. I don't even know how they should celebrate it, or how they can, but I guess it's.
Exactly. So in fact, leftists, don't be hypocrites. Don't celebrate Thanksgiving. Just wait for Karl Marx's birthday and then you can celebrate that. Okay. So celebrating the 400th anniversary of Thanksgiving, Jeff Minnick says, okay, this is just sad. Nearly half of all Americans will ask guests to provide proof of vaccination status this Thanksgiving. Andrew Stanton of Newsweek reports, others are asking the unvaxxed to provide proof of negative COVID tests, while half of American households will require guests to wear masks during the Thanksgiving festivities. I understand some people are morbidly afraid of this virus. For months now, they have avoided large gatherings, generally leaving their homes only to shop for necessities. Just the other day, I saw a 60-something man driving in a convertible with the top down. He was wearing a mask. Nonetheless, I find it stunning that so many Americans will require Thanksgiving guests to produce a vaccine passport and to mask up. The only good news here is that for last year's celebrations, two-thirds of Americans plan to wear masks, so at least the numbers have fallen in that department. But let's take a break from the masks and vaccines and revisit the first Thanksgiving. In September of 1620, 102 passengers set sail on the Mayflower for the New World. By the following autumn, only 52 of these people remained alive. Yet they, along with 90 Wampanoag Indians, devoted 3 days to a Thanksgiving feast celebrating their harvest. Nearly half of this company of pilgrims, men, women, and children, either died aboard ship or perished during the first winter in the new land. Did the survivors not grieve the loss of a child, a spouse, or a friend? Did the terrible odds they faced not daunt them or frighten them? Undoubtedly. Yet they had enough grit to throw a Thanksgiving party. So what's the difference between us and them? How could they possibly be bold enough to feel gratitude after enduring so many horrible trials? Answering that question requires us to ask to whom the pilgrims were giving thanks in the first place. That answer is easy. To God. They were Christian believers who saw the hand of God in the survival of their colony and who placed themselves under the power and protection of a heavenly power. Now, let's hop forward to 2021 and another COVID Thanksgiving. Here we should ask ourselves some questions. What are we thankful for? Why are we giving thanks? And to who and who is it, I would say whom, and who is it exactly that we're thanking? Given the widespread fear and risk aversion at work in our culture, we can conclude many Americans lack the faith of those old stalwarts. Yet how we answer those questions is how we'll celebrate Thanksgiving. This year, 2021, marks the 400th anniversary of that first Thanksgiving. That commemorative date alone should add luster to our Thanksgiving celebration. But given our pandemic and COVID fears, I'm hoping for more. Here's my wish list for all of us this November 25th. Let's make a grand feast of this day. Let's gather together with relatives and friends, fill our homes with the aroma of turkey and baking pies, and play board games and charades. Let's sing some hymns and songs about America and watch football games on television, or better yet, head out to the yard and toss a football around with the younger set. Let's laugh until our jaws grow sore. Let's put aside any talk of politics and the pandemic and focus instead on enjoying one another. Let's tell stories to the grandkids or have them tell stories to us. Let's call those relatives and friends we won't see at this party and tell them how much we love them. Let's end the day slumped in a chair or a sofa, utterly spent by the festivities. Most of all, let's do as the pilgrims did and remember that this day is for giving thanks. Let's tell those around us what we're grateful for and why. In the film Braveheart, William Wallace, played by Mel Gibson, at one point says, "Every man dies, not every man truly lives." This Thanksgiving, let's live. I like that article. Let that kind of simmer for a bit out there.
Yeah, I do. That's a nice one. Yeah, that's a very nice one.
Did you know this was the 400th Thanksgiving?
Not until you said earlier in the week. Yeah, otherwise I did not.
Yeah, yeah.
It's pretty amazing.
It's amazing how little holidays are known. I mean, they don't talk about Veterans Day. Well, that one gets talked about. Memorial Day gets talked about. But we've lost our president's birthdays, you know, Washington and Lincoln. Now it's just President's Day, which doesn't mean anything. Our holidays, you know, completely miss the point. You know, it's like, you know, President's Day used card sale. You know, it's President's Day. Let's go to the beach and, you know, buy whatever it is they're selling this week. But yeah, Thanksgiving is for giving thanks. And the really important part to me in that article is, what are you giving thanks for and who are you giving thanks to? Well, you're not giving thanks to the government.
Right. Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of places you're not giving thanks to, you know, giving thanks to God. That's what the holiday is all about. It's like Christmas. Christmas isn't about, you know, stockings and presents and things like that. It's about Jesus being born. You know, that seems to get lost in the entire shuffle of things, which is really too bad. So if you don't know what Christmas is all about, get the old Charlie Brown Christmas special and watch the speech by Linus, and he'll explain it to you. You know, do they even show that anymore at Christmas time? Is that even allowed on the secular networks?
I don't know. I think so. I would think so, but maybe not. I don't know. I don't watch TV, so I'm a bad one to ask about that.
Yeah. Well, I do, but it's like, you know, most of my time is spent on the news, and most of that time is One American News, because some of the other news places I can't stand. You know, I used to be able to watch Fox. Occasionally I watch Fox. Tucker Carlson's probably the only one, and I'm surprised he gets away with the stuff he gets away with, because he's openly accusing the other networks, you know, of being communists and you know, completely biased news and shredding the truth and all kinds of other things. And so it's really interesting. And I'll check out his interview with Tucker Carlson. Anyway, we're open hour here if anybody wants to join us. 215-383-3832. And, of course, let me check. Is anybody with live chat this morning? Let's see. Do we have any of our perennial people?
I can't get into the studio today.
Oh, okay.
So
well, I got a new
no
person
idea.
Logged in. I've got someone logged in, new person, Sirik414. So Sirik414, if you want to make a comment, feel free. And don't be afraid. You can be controversial. Just don't do a personal attack. That's all I ask. But you can be as bold and controversial as you want. That is not a problem. So, yeah, feel free. Okay, I'll check back in a little bit, and we'll see if you have something going on here. Yeah, so I need to know what I need to do. So I found another news source here. This is RSBN. I think it's where's their official title? Right Station Broadcast, you know, Right Something Broadcast News. This is the one that Trump highlighted. And they hadn't done a lot. They were sort of like this minimal mini news place that would occasionally, you know, broadcast live. I think they started broadcasting Trump rallies. And Trump highlighted them one day and said, "Hey, I love this really Right Station Broadcast News or whatever." Guys, you put your title on the top of the website so I can find it. Make my life easier. Anyway, so the minute Trump announced them, they became huge. And so now they're all over the place. Let's see if they say it at the bottom of their website. Guys, I'm trying to give you credit here. I'm trying to do the journalist thing. Just says RSBN. Yeah, okay, you're not helping me, people. All right, so you were asking about the election earlier. This is the most amazing development so far. Wisconsin lawmaker moves to decertify the state's 2020 election results, which is just what I was talking about. In other words, decertifying before the audit, they haven't done the full forensic audit, but they have enough evidence to decertify. And so then they can move to the full audit and find out the exact stuff of what's going on. In other words, to prevent further damage. That's why the precedent for this is really simple. The Fifth Circuit Court did not let millions of people get vaccinated and then say you can't have the mandate. They suspended the mandate immediately because damage was being done. Every day that Brandon occupies the White House, damage is being done. I mean, look at the energy thing we were just talking about. So the correct response to someone who stole the White House is to prevent them from doing anything when there's an ongoing investigation. You know, you just freeze them and say, okay, you can't make any policy. You're there in an emergency. Worst comes to worst because somebody has to be there. But the best thing would have been to decertify, put Trump back in, and then go through the audits. You know, it's like with Nixon. Nixon stayed, they didn't throw him out. You know, well, that's probably a bad example because, you know, he was allowed to stay there until they did. That's a different thing. But votes have to be proven correct. You know, you don't assume that a vote is a legal vote until you prove it. You know, so it's a very different thing. Whereas people are innocent until proven guilty is a complete opposite standard. I think I probably confuse people more than anything. So let me just get to the article here. Timothy Fred, November 18th, 2021, Wisconsin lawmaker moves to decertify the state's 2020 election results. That means that the electors for Wisconsin, and everything seems to be happening in Wisconsin right now, the electors would be disqualified. They would be decertified. They would be taken off, Brandon's count. And his election count, his electoral count would lower by 10. A few more states do that, and he won't have enough to, keep stealing the White House. Article says, President Trump congratulated State Representative Tim Remthun, R-A-M-T-H-U-N. I bet you he's getting death threats already. Republican of Wisconsin on Thursday for presenting a resolution to decertify the 2020 presidential election in Wisconsin. Quote, congratulations to Tim Remthun, State Representative of Wisconsin, for putting forward a powerful and very popular, because it's true, resolution to decertify the 2020 presidential election based on the recently found absolute proof of large-scale voter fraud that took place. And the person that said that was one and only Donald Trump. Liz Harrington, who's working with the Trump crew, I forgot her exact position, says congratulations to Tim Remthun. Oh, yeah, that's the same statement. So he's got a statement here, you know, by Donald Trump. And it goes on, Representative Remthun's resolution details tremendous amounts of election fraud, including 44,272 voters who did not show proper voter identification, which alone is more than twice the margin necessary to win. Also, thousands of emails that show election manipulation by Mark Zuckerberg's funding. There you go, Mr. Marxist himself. Irregularities in the state's voter registrations, like 400 registered voters at a single address. Yeah. The Wisconsin Election Commission committing felony crimes by knowingly ordering illegal voting at nursing homes, and so much more. Yeah, so Wisconsin's a cesspool of fraud right now. And so this would be nice to see them overturn that. Article says Remthun, hope I'm pronouncing that right, resolution calls for a full forensic and physical and cyber audit to be conducted in Wisconsin based on evidence of widespread voter fraud in the 2020 election. Wisconsin Republicans claim the bipartisan Legislative Audit Bureau report found 44,272 voters did not have proper voter ID. The audit report was also the only piece of evidence that prompted Remthun's resolution. Well, it was not the only piece of evidence that prompted Rentham's resolution to decertify the election. The state representative claims that the Wisconsin Election Commission intentionally directed all 72 county clerks to violate state statutes in the 2020 election. And of course, they got more details and all kinds of stuff like that. So, Rentham, here we have Reed J. Epstein, tweeted, just in from Wisconsin, a joint resolution proposed by GOP state rep Timothy Rentham, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, to decertify the 2020 election, reclaim Wisconsin's 10 electoral votes from Biden, and conduct a full forensic and physical and cyber audit for the election. So here it is. It's resolved by the Assembly, the Senate concurring, that the accumulated evidence proves the actions taken by the Elections Commission is to certify the 2020 presidential election shall be considered fraudulent under Wisconsin statute section 12-13, yada, yada, yada. Resolved that the Wisconsin legislature, pursuant to the authority under Article 2, Section 1, Clause 2, and the 9th and 10th Amendments of the U.S. Constitution, reclaims Wisconsin's 10 fraudulent electoral ballots cast for Joseph R. Biden and Kamala Harris, and be it further resolved, this is a good bill, that the Wisconsin legislature shall pass legislation with the intention to clean up the WIS vote database and create separate servers for active and inactive voters, and be it further resolved that the Wisconsin legislature supports a full forensic, physical, and cyber audit of the 2020 general election, that this full forensic, physical, and cyber audit should be conducted by an independent and nonpartisan auditing firm approved by the Assembly Committee on the Campaign and Elections, and that this full forensic, physical, and cyber audit must include the following components, and of course they go on with all kinds of other stuff. Pretty decent bill, huh? What do you think of Wisconsin? I'm impressed.
Yeah, that's wonderful. That's wonderful because Arizona's doing nothing.
Well, they did it the other way, too. Now this is interesting with what Wisconsin's doing. In other words, they want to decertify. They've already found enough evidence to prove overwhelmingly that the vote was a fraud. In fact, they've got twice as many illegal registrations as the margin of victory. Okay, that's significant. But what they're doing is they want to decertify now and then do the forensic audit, which makes perfect sense to me because the longer Brandon stays in office, the more damage he's going to do illegally. You know, and they've already shown that Wisconsin, you know, they don't know how much fraud there is. I mean, the whole purpose of a forensic audit is to find the exact detail of how much there is. But if you've already proven that you've got twice the number of fraudulent votes than the margin of victory, you know, and those votes, I assume, are all for Brandon, the ones they're finding, or at least the vast majority of them. If you've already proven that, and there's so many more cases of fraud, like I say, 400 people at one address, you know, dead voters voting, illegal aliens voting, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you know, that's enough to decertify. They don't have to find every last vote to decertify. In fact, you should be able to decertify even if the vote margin of fraud is less than the amount to change the outcome. You know, it's like if you rob a 7-Eleven of $20, you're not going to put the 7-Eleven out of business, but you're still going to go to jail for robbery. Okay. Same thing with election fraud. If you commit election fraud, it doesn't matter how much election fraud you commit. If it's proven you committed election fraud, I don't care if it's one vote. That's still election fraud. You don't have to change the outcome. But I think it's easier and more believable and more plausible to change to decertify if you have more than the amount required to change the outcome of the vote if you get rid of the fraud. So I think they're standing on pretty good ground of decertifying first and then finding out the full extent of how much fraud there is beyond the fraud they've already discovered. What do you think? Bring Jean back.
No, that's true. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's true. I just, I hope they actually do something about it. I mean, because it's ridiculous. Some, I don't know, people just need to be held accountable for all the illegal things that happened last year in the election, because they are doing nothing to change it for next year's election, and they did nothing to change it for just in November's election.
Yeah. You know, and that's a claim we've been making here a lot, is that unless you fix 2020, you're never going to have a 2022. You just aren't. You know, because if they cheated then, they can cheat this time. You know, and I don't trust the geldings to get it right. Now, certain Republicans at the state and local level are doing some pretty amazing things, and a few Republicans at the national level are doing some pretty amazing things. But the truth is that the majority of Republicans are geldings, and they're doing nothing. You know, you've got geldings voting for the stimulus bills with the Democrats. So that doesn't help you. I should get the full resolution. I should get this full bill. I'm going to take a look at it probably for next week. and or maybe Friday. I haven't quite decided yet. But the idea that they that they're going ahead with this, and we'll see what happens. I mean, there's, you know, we don't know yet. They proposed it. Obviously, this is Thanksgiving. No one's going to vote today. They'll probably get to it, I'd say, next week. And we'll see what happens. Should be interesting. All right, let me play our Santa Rosa Volunteers piece for this week, and I'll be making a new one. I'll be making the Anti-Federalist number 7 here pretty soon. We got David Jones joining us at 7 o'clock. I'll make sure to get my my Ed Colley, you know, spot in for our webmaster pretty soon. And I think, at least I hope, by Monday we should have our brand-new Write Your Laws website out. And that's going to be good. That's going to be good for all the new folks. We're going to send out a huge press release for that. If you want to get on our press release list, send something to greg@writeyourlaws.com. And if we can, you know, if you're just an individual, you know, you'll be able to hear the stuff. But if you're an organization, especially a media organization that wants to know more about what we do, then I'd be pleased to have you on our list. All right, let me get to this, and we'll be back in about 6-7 minutes.
This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, insights into our founding documents, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers here in Santa Rosa County, Florida. Santa Rosa Volunteers is available at their website, srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. In Federalist Paper number 7, Alexander Hamilton once again beats the same dead horse he trotted out in his first Federalist Paper, that the Constitution has to be ratified or the states will end up divided in 3 or so groups or will cause other nations to invade us. Upping the ante now, he claims that we will all be at war with ourselves in this paper, and once again the cure is to ratify the Constitution. Ironic again that the Constitution was in full force when the states did divide, but in a unified way against the federal government created by the Constitution and not in the 3 or 4 separate confederacies as argued by Hamilton and the Federalists, but one confederacy of states who were run by the Democrat Party. Be careful what you wish for. Hamilton begins with this question. It is sometimes asked with an air of seeming triumph, what inducements could the states have if disunited to make war upon each other? This is a preposterous question, given that the states were united under the Articles of the Confederacy, and that no states were at war or were, to my knowledge, trying to take each other's territory. So Hamilton asks a question that requires an assumption that doesn't exist. Therefore, a legitimate answer cannot be given. But that's not the point of the question. The point is to plant in your brain that if the states became disunited, what would save the Union? And the only answer Hamilton wants you to consider is the new Constitution. Hamilton also says, we have a vast tract of unsettled territory within the boundaries of the United States. There are still discordant and undecided claims between several of them, and the dissolution of the Union would lay a foundation for similar claims between them all. Well, yes, the dissolution of the Union would cause territorial disputes, but to use that as a reason to ratify the Constitution, you have to believe two things. One, that there is going to be a dissolution of the Union under the Articles of Confederation, and two, that there will be no dissolution of the Union nor any territorial disputes if the Constitution is ratified. Both of those are impossible to argue as connected or even probable individually. Therefore, the argument for the Constitution from the Federalists is based solely on their fertile imagination of what they think will scare the people who would vote to ratify the Constitution the most. If this is in fact the case, then the Constitution was argued from a huge pyramid of ever-increasing lies designed to channel all thinking to a predetermined outcome without real examination, because the building block evidence and arguments of the Federalists crumble at the slightest scrutiny. They knew that, but argued it that way anyway. Kind of sounds like the government position on COVID since early 2020. Hamilton concludes, from the view they have exhibited of this part of the subject, this conclusion is to be drawn, that America, if not connected at all, or only by the feeble tie of a simple league, offensive and defensive, would, by the operation of such jarring alliances, be gradually entangled in all the pernicious labyrinths of European politics and wars, and by the destructive contentions of the parts into which she was divided, would be likely to become a prey to the artifices and machinations of powers equally the enemies of all of them. Divide and conquer must be the motto of every nation that either hates or fears us. At the end of this Federalist paper, Alexander Hamilton has tied together every preposterous proposition he is making with the hope that enough bogus fears will be grouped together, and the simple weight of numbers of so many ridiculous assumptions will somehow, as a group, give them credibility. Divide and conquer. I wonder if he would have used race like it's used today, if he could. The source for the Federalist Papers is federalistpapers.org. The Anti-Federalist Papers are from selfeducatedamerican.com. The Articles of Confederation are from usconstitution.net. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers. Their website is srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Please share this report to anyone who needs it. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with a personal recommendation and testimonial for Eric Colley, our new webmaster and marketing guru. Eric has been invaluable in upgrading our website, writeyourlaws.com. To help you with your marketing, Eric Colley offers proven, cost-effective strategies to help small businesses, startups, and nonprofits market themselves on Google Page One. You can gain thousands of followers and be far more competitive, and this is the good part, without paid advertising. Most business owners don't have the time or expertise to excel at marketing. Even fewer have the funds to hire a special employee. And you don't have to. There is a better option. Eric Colley, a consultant who uses leading-edge marketing strategies to increase your profitability at costs which are far more affordable than an advertising or marketing agency. You can be seen high up in Google's Page One. You can dominate Google's local three-pack of businesses next to the search results map. You can increase foot and website traffic. Eric Colley can be reached at 208-999-7510. That's 208-999-7510. His website is besmallbusiness.com. BESMALLBUSINESS. And you can reach him by email at eric@besmallbusiness.com. And that's how you do it.
Action Radio. Dangerously cool.
All right, so we've got about 7 minutes or so before David Jones joins us as Santa Rosa Volunteers, and so we get to talk about all kinds of things. Not the Federalist Paper so much. That's their project for me, so they've commissioned me to make these episodes every week on our Federalist Papers, and it's going to take a while. It's going to take a couple of years before this is done, but we've got them up to Federalist Paper number 7. Of course, we'll do the Anti-Federalist. I've covered some of the Articles of Confederation, the Declaration of Independence, the Sedition Act, but mostly we'll be going over the Federalist Papers because it really describes what happened at our founding. And what I had no idea about was the amount of debate. I thought, you know, the Articles of Confederation sucked and the Constitution was great and everybody was happy with that. Well, apparently not, that wasn't the case. And so I'm finding that I find myself siding much more with the Anti-Federalists in terms of a much more authoritarian Constitution than ever existed in the Articles of Confederation, which in many respects I don't think were given a chance. And I think with certain modifications, like a Bill of Rights, might have been a lot better. In fact, a lot of the articles in the Articles of Confederation ended up in the Bill of Rights after, like 10 years after the Constitution was ratified. So the Federalists didn't think it necessary to put rights into their Constitution, and they had to be added later, which tells me everything I needed to know about the Federalists. And so that's a whole whole different thing. But so we've got a few minutes here, and of course we have some time with David, David Jones and Dave Schneier. We got two Daves today, Gene, so we're going to get confused. But anybody wants to call in during either of those folks or now, you know, 215-383-3832. I imagine a lot of people are shopping and having fun and going crazy. And, you know, and if you're international, we do have a Skype line. And if you want to tell us about, you know, if you have anything close to Thanksgiving or if you're kind of curious about our holiday, feel free. You know, like how the turkey came to be the bird of Thanksgiving. Gene, do people eat turkey any other time of year? Or are all the birds, you know, sort of geared for this one feast and then they kind of stop for a while? Because I've eaten turkey all the time. You know, I used to make it like, because it tasted better than chicken. So I eat turkey drumsticks and thighs and, you know, I get parts because I wouldn't get a whole turkey, which is for me. I didn't need a whole one. But yeah, turkey's good meat.
Yeah, pretty much I think people eat turkey all year, but definitely okay. Thanksgiving is the biggest, I think, probably the amount of people eating it at one time. It's interesting because I was talking to a lot of people over the last couple of days who were talking mm-hmm. about Thanksgiving mm-hmm. and what they like to eat, and I can't tell you how many people said, I'm not turkey. they're like, we get turkey all the time, but interesting because everybody's perception is different, but yeah, I think definitely turkey and ham is probably the big thing now, but turkey definitely.
We had Paulette yesterday made the rather interesting claim that we should have fish because it's the most nutritious of the foods out there. I mean, I don't know how I do a Thanksgiving salmon. You know, do you put stuffing in it? In fact, that's the question I forgot to ask her, was about the stuffing, which is probably the worst part of it. Bread, spices.
Well, yeah, exactly, because there's bread. So she'd probably say do it a little bit different, you know,
yeah.
with other bread. Or start a new tradition. I always think that's cool. It's like, even for Christmas, so many people have certain things for Christmas, and then you get others that totally have something totally, totally different. And it's like, you know what? It's your holiday. You can make it any way you want.
Yeah, I don't think Jesus would care what you had at Christmas. You know, I don't think that the pilgrims would care what you had for Thanksgiving. And I bet you they had fish. You know, I mean,
right.
who knows if they even had turkeys where they were in New England. You know, I don't think that Easter time, you know, anybody cares. We have Easter foods. Easter's kind of funny. I'll probably bring this out again. I'll have to make my promo for, Muslim hot cross buns. You know, go to your local Muslim bakery for hot cross buns, you know, just to be a multicultural, you know. And that was always my thing, because we used to have a Muslim bakery when I lived in Oakland. And it was always my I never did it, but I always thought it'd be funny to walk in and say, excuse me, it's Easter time. Do you have any hot cross buns? Just to get the reaction from, you know, your Muslim bakery. That's what it used to be called. And I used to go there, actually. It's pretty good stuff. You know, it was kind of cool. So one thing I liked about the Bay Area was you literally have every culture and every food and everything, you know, every cultural, religious, you know, culinary thing you could possibly imagine from all over the world is in the Bay Area. And that was the good part about it. That part is the liberals screwed it up and ruined it. But it was fun to be able to go to Muslim bakeries. It was a new experience. Anyway, but maybe I'll make my parody later. But yeah, so Thanksgiving, you know, it seems to be relegated to the turkey. What's interesting, me being Canadian by birth and Australian by residence growing up as a kid, so childhood experience, you know, part of the British Commonwealth. And the way the British Commonwealth has regulated everything, it's supposed to be Thanksgiving turkey, Christmas goose, and Easter ham. So if you want to follow the British tradition, of course, that would be plum pudding at Christmas time, and I forgot, I guess, you know, pumpkin pie at Thanksgiving. And I'm not sure what the Easter dessert is other than chocolate rabbits. Is there an Easter dessert? Is there a classic one? I think Easter's kind of like different.
I don't think so. I've never heard of it.
Okay, I'll have to make one. Anyway, if I wanted to do a Florida Thanksgiving, I'd probably have like pompano and key lime pie. You know, I'd like stacks of pompano, which is beautiful fish, you know, and like, you know, like a half a key lime pie just to myself. That would be my Florida Thanksgiving. So it would be interesting if people had regional, you know, things, you know, maybe out in the Great Plains to get, you know, a Buffalo Thanksgiving, you know, and of course along the West Coast and the East Coast, you know, like a lobster New England tradition. Actually, you know what? I forgot to call some friends of mine on Fisherman's Wharf. I can't believe I did this. I'll have to make a big note to myself to call them right after Thanksgiving. But I have friends on Fisherman's Wharf when I used to be a tour guide there. And so let me put a big note. Actually, I'm going to call them today after the show. See if I can get them on for next week. I can't believe I forgot this. Because in San Francisco, the big Thanksgiving tradition is Dungeness Crab. All you folks around the country are laughing at me right now. I know. I understand.
Oh,
that.
Yeah.
But they do. Yeah, Dungeons is crap. In fact, I'm a they ship, by the way. It's the Alioto Lazio Fish Company. And so it's run by a couple of sisters now. Their grandparents started it. And it's a fabulous place. It's one of the few family fishing businesses left in San Francisco, which is so commercial now. And this sort of, you know, Fisherman's Wharf really was a place where the fish came in. I mean, the whole point of it was the fish came into Fisherman's Wharf and people would buy, you know, seafood. The restaurants and stores would buy seafood right from the boat as they docked. I mean, it doesn't get fresher than that, especially in the earlier days, the 1800s, 1900s, early 1900s. You didn't have as much refrigeration. I mean, you had ice. So you pack your fish in ice, you hop it on the wagon, horse wagon, you get it to your restaurant or shop, you keep it on ice, or you cook it, you know, that day. You know, seafood being very perishable, but San Francisco had wonderful fresh seafood. And California was really good environmentally about the Dungeness crab of keeping the supply because they only harvest the males. And so you have a female can lay like, a million and a half eggs, you know, so you keep the females in the water. And they harvest the males. So, and there's plenty of crab out there, you know, just lots of them. So they've managed it quite well. So there's plenty of crab to eat and there's plenty of crab to make more crab. It works out really well. So that would be a sustainable, you know, resource. But yeah, Dungeness crab, Thanksgiving tradition, a long time. Be interesting to see if there are other traditions around the country, you know, so feel free to let us know. Unfortunately, like I say, most people are still doing the podcast. So email me, greg@writeyourlives.com, or just call another episode. Something like that, but that'd be fun. Well, you're up in the middle of the Midwest. What would be, I think, traditional Thanksgiving in your neighborhood these days, even though you're kind of a new resident up there?
Yeah, well, you know, it's still the typical turkey, ham, turkey mainly. But the thing is with that, because you know, I am in the Midwest, it would, if you would say, like, fish in Florida, it would probably be beef in Minnesota. And, you know, it's like you'd get a lot of people saying, oh, I don't eat beef. But, you know, there is a lot of farmers in Minnesota, North, South Dakota, Wisconsin area, Iowa. Yeah.
Yeah, the farm, I always wonder about the growing season up there because winter comes harshly, you know, especially in the Canadian farms just north of you guys up in Alberta and Saskatchewan. You know, that's the breadbasket of North America. You know, that whole area. And then, of course, you get further down south, there's much more of a growing season. California still produces huge amounts of produce, strawberries, lettuce, celery, almonds, avocados, things like that. And so that growing season, you know, it's got to be short, you know, but they have wonderful farms. They have cheese, you know, cheese is a big thing in Wisconsin. So, of course, now I have to ask, now that I mentioned cheese, is there a Thanksgiving cheese?
No, but I mean, people can. I think people maybe, I don't know, be interesting. I guess I would say probably Thanksgiving would be maybe more the brie, wrapping it in something like crescent roll or something. But I would say Christmas time would be the cream cheese and putting pepper jelly on it and then eating it with crackers or something.
Okay. Well, I've seen the port wine. It'll take like cheddar and port wine.
No.
But, walnuts around it or something like that.
Cheese balls. Yeah.
Cheese balls.
The Christmas is very popular. Yeah.
Okay.
The reason I did the cream cheese and pepper jelly, that's one year my niece got, she was young at the time. that's what she did for Christmas. She says, yeah, it was just really interesting. It's like, I had never seen that before. So I guess it's like, okay, what rock did I crawl on from under? But yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny. I've gotten away from a lot of the traditions. I used to do Christmas cards at Christmas, you know, before there was an internet back in my early 20s. And I remember Thanksgiving, and there was a soup kitchen I used to go volunteer in. And there's a lot of things I used to do that, especially with Action Radio, it's just, it is so busy, and we're trying to get so many things going here. But there was a time, and I remember doing some other stuff. So I think, you know, volunteering, especially you young folks, get out and do some volunteer work. You know, I'm not trying to, you know, blow my own horn here, but I've cleaned seabirds using Dawn, you know, from oil spills and had loons poop all over me. But it was worth it. It was fun. I was cleaning seabirds, right? You know, and been at work at soup kitchens and, you know, fed the homeless and done some other stuff. And it really, if you get a chance to do something like that, it really is a privilege. I mean, you know, you're not just volunteering.
It really
is,
yeah.
You know, you feel better for doing so, and you feel like you've accomplished something. So, yeah. Gene, have you had a chance to do some volunteer stuff?
Oh, yeah. I did more stuff years ago than I'm doing now. But, yeah, it is. It's wonderful.
Yeah, so all you youngsters, get out there and do some volunteer stuff. Then you can sit back and talk about it later.
Really need
like
to connect with people. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, this is kind of fun talking about this stuff because we don't get a chance a lot of times to because we have so much news to go over. And I got more news here, too. We covered actually a couple of ones. The 400th anniversary of Thanksgiving, I wanted to cover the Wisconsin decertification vote, which I think is critical. Arizona needs to do that, too. As soon as we get the first one, the dominoes are going to fall. You know, it's going to be fascinating to watch, especially
woo-hoo.
During. Gee, exactly, woohoo! Yeah, let's give let's get the Chinese gong announcement here. Let me see if I can find it right here. And now announcing the decertification votes. Yes, and maybe we can remove the Chinese ambassador to the White House, Joseph Biden.
When that happens, instead of the gong, you need to play something like Hallelujah or something like that. You know, it's like, woo-hoo.
Oh,
yeah.
I got the Stars and Stripes forever. Yeah, I got Stars and Stripes. You know, I can play that. So we got some fun stuff we can play here. So let me go over. Maybe I'll save my Christmas one for next week, but let me see if I can find a funny piece. Do you want to hear, because we got a little bit of time to play here. Do you want to hear the New Normal Church and Grocery Store? Or should I do my Christmas thing again? Or do you have any requests for any of my rather silly promotional things here?
Do the grocery store one.
Yeah, that is still the favorite. All right. So just to give folks a quick clue of what happened, during the lockdowns, which I found absurd, I get really creative. And I'm locked down. I can't go anywhere. I can't go to my favorite restaurants. I can't go out. There's no place to go. You know, we're basically under house arrest. The beaches are closed. And all this really... you know, crazy stuff that was all proven to be wrong, and DeSantis actually reversed himself, was going on. And the fact that I found it fascinating that the stores were open, the food stores, the big food stores especially, you know, like Winn-Dixie, Publix around here, and grocery stores in your area were open, but the churches were closed. So I thought, well, if we combine the two of them, you know, maybe we get both of them done, and that's when I came up with this. Hello, America. Looks like millions of you are in states where the governor dictator has said that food is essential, but God is not. Fortunately, we have a solution for you. We've combined your essential food shopping with a non-essential religious experience. Being in the same building and being completely intertwined, you can't do one without the other. Welcome to the New Normal Church and Grocery Store. Yes, the New Normal Church and Grocery Store is the first business of its kind to bring God conveniently into your food shopping aisle. Think of this as food for your body and food for your soul. No social distance or group size restrictions here. Upon entering the New Normal Church and Grocery Store, you will pick up your shopping cart. You can then choose from an optional mask with a Star of David, a cross, a crescent moon, a sun for you Shintos, a statue of Buddha, and for you agnostics, a question mark. Headsets are available to play sermons throughout your shopping experience. Some of the favorites include I'm Going to Heaven and You're Not, Die Infidel Die, Oi, What Not to Say During the Bris, and That Butterfly May Be Your Grandfather. To orient you to the store, the Kosher Jewish Deli is by the Western Wall. A simple shalom gets you service, but be prepared to haggle. For you Muslims, out of courtesy, we put the Halal Butcher by the Eastern Wall. Sharia store policies require the wearing of both a burqa and a mask, just to be safe. Protestants will find the Wonder Bread, hot dogs, and steak in the central aisles, where all the best-dressed customers can also be found. When you notice the smell of incense, you are nearing the Buddhist section, which is all vegetarian. For Catholics, communion is available in the bakery department by the wafers, near the red wine section. Agnostics should go directly to customer service, because you folks have no idea what you want anyway. Be sure to offer your confessional to the checker on the way out if you so choose. Please don't forget to first pull down the blind on the plexiglass screen. And if you require ministering, you can talk to your bagger as they push your groceries to your car, because all our baggers are cross-trained in theology. The New Normal Church and Grocery Store, your combination alternative to the separation of church by the state. See, this is what happens when I get upset. I get creative. Don't make me mad. I'm just going to broadcast my sarcasm. But, yeah, and it never ceased to amaze me how many churches closed, you know, because they basically gave up. They, you know, these are places that are supposed to have a moral influence over Washington and politics and the state capitals and things like that. I mean, we have a separation of, you know, of government from church in the First Amendment, but not a separation from church over government. In other words, churches have to be and should be a moral force in society as a counter to the excesses of the amoral government. I mean, that's the whole point of a church. You know, this is where a good nation, a religious nation, a nation of good people, you know, with morals and values is essential for a successful republic. And so it just, I never understood the church's closing. I mean, maybe they had their 501c3 tax status in jeopardy or for whatever reason, or maybe they were just, you know, good servants of the state, which is not what the church is supposed to do. You know, it's the churches in Poland that helped bring about the freedom. You know, it was Lech Walesa and Solidarity Movement, but it was the churches. It was Pope John Paul II, you know, that led the way. You know, it's churches in many countries that lead the way to freedom, you know, because God intends that people be free. I mean, this is where all this comes from. You know, it's really hard to have a belief in freedom unless you have a belief in God, too, because, you know, where do your rights come from? Your rights, if you believe your rights come from government, then those aren't rights, those are privileges, and those privileges can be taken away. And you know, like in China, you have to have, you know, right thinking and right actions, and you're awarded privileges back, you know, based on your compliance to the state. Well, those aren't rights. You know, the state of Florida, which had these bills, they had come up, the Parental Bill of Rights, had all these extra clauses, like, you know, you have the right to, you know, be informed about any crime against your child, unless, you know, it might interfere with an investigation somehow. You know, you have the right to, determine the health procedures for your kid, unless, you know, the state determines otherwise. You know, they had all these exceptions to it. Well, those aren't rights. Yeah, they're not rights if the laws, you know, can supersede your rights. That the whole point of a right is that nothing can supersede it. You know, those are rights that are given to natural law, given to you by God as a birthright, you know, above government. And so rights are above laws. Rights are above government. That's what makes rights rights. And if you don't believe that, if you don't believe in God, I don't know how you can believe in rights, quite honestly. Gene, what do you think?
No, it's true. But I think with the churches and closing down, basically they were being fined. You know, look at that poor pastor in Canada that's been arrested how many times just because he held church services. I think it's crazy. It's like and I hope I'm wrong, but I don't think we've seen anything yet. If you look at what's going on the rest of the world and the craziness that's happening with the things being locked down again and all that, it's like, mm-hmm. Wow.
Well, which brings up another one of the articles I have sitting here, and this is vaccine martial laws in Austria. You know,
yeah.
So go ahead.
Yeah, I didn't mean to interrupt, but just before before you begin, because mm-hmm. we have a I don't even want to say a leader in this country, the person who's acting as president, I don't know what else to call him. The thing is, he's a puppet. He's a he's a puppet, meaning he can't come up with his own ideas. He'll say he did, but he doesn't. He follows. He's a sheep and follows the crowd. And so whatever's going on in other parts of the world, that's what he's going to do versus keeping us in our freedom. No, he wants to even take more of our freedoms away. And so I hope mm-hmm. to gosh, the Supreme Court, those guys get some cahootas and start taking what they're supposed to do and do it and not just pass the buck or pass it along or just do what Biden wants.
Did you say cahootas?
Yes, because they need some. I mean, they really do need some.
I think you mean
some.
Cojones.
It's like, that too.
I could be wrong. We'll have to look up cahootas. I've never heard that expression.
I'm just like, come on, people. We need to start doing something. It's like what you were talking about before, about Wisconsin and the election. Mm-hmm. Look how long Arizona's been saying that, you know, what needs to be done. Well, why aren't they doing it?
That's a good question. I don't know. They should have decertified as soon as that audit result came out. They should have decertified right there. In fact, they could have decertified beforehand, because once they had the overwhelming evidence there's enough fraud to show that the election, you know, that there's enough to overturn the results or change the results, that should be enough right there to decertify. Just because you don't have every last vote in a whole forensic audit, you don't need every last vote. You just have to prove fraud.
And
I said, even less than enough to overturn, if there's fraud, you still disqualify.
Thing is with that, mm-hmm. it's like if they're arresting people that had something to do with being with Trump on January 6th, mm-hmm. why aren't they arresting the people that were subpoenaed and didn't do what they were supposed to do? It's like, it's all one-sided.
That's a good question. Yep.
All one-sided.
Well, politicians have a certain amount of immunity, otherwise they'd never do anything. Because if you could be arrested for every decision that you make, you know, sometimes they're really tough decisions. You know, when a president decides to go to war legitimately, that's a tough decision. There are people that are going to object to that, and rightly so. Even World War II, there was a huge amount of people that objected to us getting into it. I probably would have been one of them until, you know, Pearl Harbor, which is why I think Pearl Harbor was an accident. But Charles Lindbergh, American patriot, was dead against World War II. He said, look, these, you know, it was bad enough we went into World War I. We shouldn't have been there. You know, if the Europeans want to kill each other every 30 years, that's their business. You know, it's got nothing to do with us. And he was called an isolationist and all these other things. And this guy's an American. You don't get much more American patriot. He fought in World War II. He was a combat pilot after, you know, flying across to Paris from New Jersey. You know, and so don't dispute his patriotism. But, yeah, there's a lot of people that were against us getting in, you know, for that reason. We could have easily defended our country in the Atlantic from the U-boats and in the Pacific from the Japanese and not necessarily had to go to war until, of course, we were attacked. And then it becomes a different story. And then, you know, you can't let that kind of thing go. And I understand our retaliation. You know, it's a very interesting thing. But still, the leaders make unpopular decisions all the time. And they have to be able to do that. So there's a certain amount of immunity that you want.
But then,
however, if it's so blatant and so criminal what they're doing, then you have to be able to arrest them too. And putting an election through that they know is fraudulent because they're actually taking part in the fraud. Yeah, that's an arrestable offense.
But you say make decisions. I don't think what's going on are even decisions they're making. Other people are making.
See, that's interesting too. That should be grounds for removal as well. If you're not acting, if you're incompetent in your job, in other words, you're not the one who's doing it. You know, thief
and
chief Brandon.
I mean, are you really
Brandon,
thinking that he is? I don't think so.
What, Brandon? Brandon is there because he's the one person who is either corrupt enough or stupid enough or both to be able to say things that are knowingly, obviously untrue, but he's able to say them anyway. The fact that he says, you know, what's the latest? We're talking about the oil supply. I mean, I forget all the things he lies about. You know, Kyle Rittenhouse is a white supremacist. Everybody involved in that whole situation was white.
Oh,
you know, so
yeah,
there's no racial element there at all. But he lied about it.
And that,
you know,
Biden said about Kyle Rittenhouse, according to Jen Psaki, no, that Biden didn't start it. Trump started it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah,
with
Trump's fault.
With all his divide and yada, yada, yada. Well, if you look back, that's the biggest bunch of BS. And I hope they sue. I hope he sues Biden, and I hope he sues Psaki, and he can sue
and
both
news media. Well, if you remember, Nick Sandman.
He just needs to have a heyday because this is insane what they're doing. And Biden, what he said last year was horrible. You know, and you look at what Trump said, two totally different things. It's like a leader like that should not be sparking more divisiveness. They should just say, you know, wait till the facts are out, let the courts decide, because that's ultimately who should decide. It shouldn't be a bobblehead political figure.
Yeah. But if you look, well, a couple of things. One, the Nick Sandman case, you know, where he was vilified with the media for standing there while, you know, an alleged Native American peaceful protester was really in his face assaulting him, you know, and you find out that he did nothing. He just stood there. You know, he didn't respond. He didn't threaten. He didn't do anything violent. And yet the media crucified him. You know, you want to talk about character assassination. He sued, I think, his attorney. You know, sued the Washington Post and I think CNN for millions of dollars.
He still has six lawsuits out pending that they haven't gone to court yet. Yeah, I didn't know that either until this week I heard an interview. Yeah, he's got quite a few lawsuits that they haven't even
well, they're
going to
want to drag out as
yet.
Long as possible. Yeah, fortunately he's young, so he'll have time to collect, you know, which is good. But, and so I imagine Kyle Rittenhouse and Nick Sandman are probably best friends now. And Nick's like, okay, here's what you do. Here's what I went through. You know, but Kyle's going
to
have lawsuits for years. Yeah, well, of course they do.
I think they need to be. I think he needs to stop listening to people that are telling – I mean, he needs to find things out for himself, because I think some of the people that are giving him counsel – or I'm not saying lawyers, but whoever's in his – his team, I don't think they're being totally honest with him. And I think he needs to just sit back and really look things through before he talks more, because I think there's just been a lot going on. And before he says it to the public either, because number one, it's like what is it going to make? It's not going to change anybody else's mind. Like someone yesterday that I listened to was saying, you need to go listen to that. You need to go listen to that. You know, it's amazing. Well, the left is not going to listen to him talk. He's not going to change their attitude, regardless what they think. He's not, or what he thinks. They're not. And so the bottom line is, it's like, you know, there's so many other ways to bring about positive change when you've gone through something. It's mm-hmm. like, find out what that is. Figure out what that is in, like him, what rings true to him, and go do it. Versus, it ain't going to change anybody's attitude. And, I'm just amazed at how he sounds. He just sounds so adult. And I mean, he is 18. But if I'd be in his case, I don't think I could have been nearly as composed as he is. So you know he's been grilled, drilled, trained. And I'm like, no, I just want the real, true Kyle, and not someone that he's portraying to be because, oh, he has to stand like this or be like this because, ooh, no, that's not going to change my attitude. In fact, I'm going to be like, oh, yeah, someone's telling him what to say, what to do, what to think, because, you know, it's like, how can you sit there like that so poised? I don't know. Maybe he can. Maybe that is all him. I don't think so.
Well, I think in some ways he has to, because they're still trying to character assassinate him. You know, the left is just looking for anything.
If
he starts coming out,
anything.
Well,
because it's not going to
change.
True. People, you know, I can't tell you one person on the left that's going to listen to him and say, oh, yeah, I guess I was wrong. I mean, there have been some, even, you know, like YouTubers and stuff that have come out and said they were wrong. But for the most part, no. And so it's like, and at this point, you know, it's still, people are still raw with that. I think he just, you know, and I don't want to compare the two, but be what OJ wasn't. Just like, be more like Sam, and where he's gone on, he's going to college, and it's like not having to be in the spotlight every second. Just let this country just be away from it for a while, because it is so polarizing.
And this is all part of the left, though. There's no reason for it to be polarizing. This was a self-defense case that never should have been brought. I mean, the evidence was clear. The prosecutors screwed up by bringing the case, and as Kyle said in the interview with Tucker Carlson, they wanted to win. But this is the case with most prosecutors across the country. Yeah.
But it's not going to change anybody's attitude, or very little. I mean, maybe 1% of the people's attitude. I don't think so, because the left is not going to listen to Tucker Carlson. They didn't listen to the trial. Or what they did listen to the trial, look what they took out of it. That
yeah, actually, there was a couple of people that said...
And then in other countries, they're saying he shot black people.
Yeah, that's pretty funny. Well, you know, if it doesn't fit the narrative, it's like, what's his name? Daryl Brooks, the person that murdered, the Dancing Grannies, I think they're called. And I don't have all the details. We'll go into more of this next week when I have a chance to study it. But Daryl Brooks, who has a lengthy criminal record, I was watching the judge last night. Daryl Brooks, who was released on $1,000 bail. I got the story finally, that he was released on $1,000 bail by John Chisholm, district attorney in Milwaukee, after either running down his girlfriend or the mother of his child or both. I'm not sure who she was. Again, nothing against her.
Yeah,
I just want to make sure I get over the story. But anyway, so he runs over this woman, gets $1,000 bail, which is nothing. You know, you only have to pay a certain percentage of that. He was out on bail, carrying a weapon, which he wasn't allowed to have, driving a vehicle, which he wasn't allowed. He's not allowed to drive vehicles. He's doing everything wrong. He should never have been out. And then he runs over these people in the crowd, and the judge is looking at this, and it was fascinating to watch this last night on One American News. The judge is absolutely horrified, but even so, he still does his job as a judge. He goes through the recommendations on bail, you know, on and how it works, and you know, and one of the check marks is the person a flight risk? And they say, well, he's definitely a risk. He's failed to meet court dates. And is this person excessively violent? Well, yeah, what he did was excessively violent. You know, is this likely to result in incarceration? And he says, yeah. In fact, any one of these murders, or alleged murders, you know, the thing the judge said, is enough to put him in jail for the rest of his life, just one of them, you know. And so he went through the list, and he says, I'm shocked at this case. I've never seen, you know, in my 40 years of being on the bench, anything this horrendous, this callous, this calculated. And he says there was definitely intent. In fact, he had two detectives, he says, in an unusual move, detectives who tried to stop this, who tried to intervene, who tried to shoot at the vehicle to stop him from going forward, you know, listed this as an intentional act, you know, and so that adds to the sentence too. So the judge actually awarded what the state recommended, $5 million bail, which to me seems appropriate. You know, but I don't know if he's going to be able to raise that. I hope not. I hope he sits in jail.
Yeah.
Because
they said,
but think about
Wisconsin,
that. $5 million bail? That's a gutsy judge, because that kind of thing gets reviewed too. Go ahead.
But they said in Wisconsin too, which I don't know enough about it in other places or anywhere, but this is just what I heard yesterday. In Wisconsin, whereas other states, you don't have to pay. You only could put, like, I don't know, whatever percent of that down. No, in Wisconsin, you have to put the whole amount down.
Oh, you do?
Before you can get out of jail, which is, yes.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, bail sentence
to be... I don't
know
if that's true. That's just what I was... That's just what I heard.
Yeah.
But that would make sense. I mean, if you have a bond for $500 million or $250 million or whatever, they should have to put that bond up before they leave, because if they don't, what's to say you're not going to leave? You know, be a flee risk.
A flight risk, yeah. See, that's the purpose of bail.
Why did they flight, but some aren't going to fly? So that's why they flee.
You're funny. If bail is too low, then, you know, especially if it's a wealthy person, you know, bail is set high on wealthier people because they have the money to leave. You know, that's why they take your passport. If you're a flight risk, you have to surrender your passport to the judge, you know, so you don't, you know, take off out of the country and go to a country with a non-extradition treaty with the United States, which means you can't be brought back. So that's the point of that. So the bail has to be enough so that you have to be able to either pay it or be able to – because innocent people have bail too. So the purpose of bail is to prepare for your trial. It's so that if you're an innocent person – I mean, all criminal justice is based on the innocent person. So for the innocent person, you know, they have to be able to have bail to get out and prepare their trial. If you're sitting in jail, you can't prepare your case. That's prejudicial to your case. And it's completely prejudicial. You don't have the opportunity to talk to your lawyers and prepare a case. You know, if Kyle Rittenhouse were confined to a jail, if he didn't have bail, you know, then he never would have been able to consult with his attorneys properly. So bail is really designed for the innocent, but you want to have enough of it so that you don't, you know, so that it costs you too much to leave. It would be a cost that you could not handle if you took off and left that bail money, you know, to the court in lieu of being tried and sentenced and things like that. So that's why they do it. But $5 million, there's no way in hell this guy has $5 million, but that's not the point. The point in this case is to keep him from going anywhere, you know, and probably to leave him in jail. So this is why that bail is so high, because the crime is so horrendous. Yeah.
And the interesting thing was, after it happened, everybody was saying about that he was only given $1,000 bail. But, you know, the thing is, it wasn't the bail on what he did over the weekend. It was the bail that he did. I don't know when he did it, last week or whenever that was.
Well, that's
it was
a separate
just
crime.
The reason that he tried. Yeah, but what I'm saying is, I think it was Monday or wherever, when I was at work and stuff, people were telling me, and I maybe have said it afterwards, after I was told that too, that he was only given $1,000 bail. But that wasn't the same, that wasn't from Sunday. That was because he hadn't been arraigned yet.
Now,
so,
this is the confusion I had yesterday. This is why I had to you know, offer a correction, as they say. So John Chisholm, district attorney of Milwaukee County, which includes the city of Milwaukee, gave him $1,000 bail when he ran over his girlfriend, mother of his kid, or both. I'm not sure who she is. I mean, I don't want to detract from her. But he ran over a woman, and that was $1,000 bail. This is a separate crime where he ran over five people, killed them. Actually, six persons died. So he killed six people and injured 40 more in a reckless act of racial hatred and terrorism, as far as I can see. It's definitely a terrorist act. Even if it's spontaneous, it's still an act of terrorism. And it's a racial attack. It's a hate crime because all the people he hit were white, I mean, as far as I know. Yeah.
The thing is, though, to be honest, and this is me talking, but to just be given $1,000 bail when you run over someone, intentionally running over someone, I think that's a pretty low amount of money too.
I mean,
even if she didn't get, she didn't die. I mean, can you imagine taking a car and trying to run someone over and running them over? I mean, that's just one person, not what he did the other day. But, oh, my God, I feel my heart goes out to the people in Wisconsin that were there. Can you imagine, especially those little kids, well, adults too, but the little kids that went there to celebrate, you know, mm-hmm. last year they couldn't have it. So this year it's like, what a, you know, yes. And then something like this happens. You talk about post-traumatic stress and, oh, my God, it's, wow. It just,
well,
it's
I think
he'd
also... Yeah, it is. And I think he'd also knife somebody right before he drove into the crowd. So he ran over his girlfriend or mother of his child or both. Like I say, I don't know how to characterize her yet. I'll have to read the stories. But then he had the $1,000, you know, bail, which he paid and got out. I mean, that was or a bail bonds person took care of that. So he's out when he shouldn't be out. Because he missed court dates, he missed other things. I think he stabbed somebody, then hopped in the SUV, and that's when he murdered those people. And so you got someone that never should have been out. This is a George Soros district attorney in Milwaukee. And then a different judge on the murder charges, he's the one that issues the $5 million bail. And so that first $1,000 bail by John Chisholm in Milwaukee, that's being investigated as an excessively low bail, insufficient bail. You know, there's no way you can bring $1,000 bail for attempted murder with a vehicle. And I don't know what the exact charge is, but it's certainly vehicular, you know, manslaughter. I don't know if the person died or not. If they did, it's at least vehicular manslaughter or some kind of thing like that. That's manslaughter. Okay. That's a murder charge. If it's premeditated, then it goes to premeditated murder, second or first degree. So yeah.
Right. I don't think she died. I could be wrong, but I think if she would have, they would have reported that. Mm-hmm. But
well, then it's attempted murder.
What I've heard is that
you know, it's at least attempted murder.
Ran her over. Yeah.
So there's a pattern for you. I mean, you know, this guy, I imagine he's going to be convicted, you know, in fairly short order. I can't see a lengthy trial on this because the video's there. Now, here's what's interesting too: video has changed trials completely. I think if Kyle Rittenhouse didn't have the video proving, you know, beyond any doubt that he was acting in self-defense, that trial might have gone completely differently. If it were the media and the jury influenced by the media and the crowd and the prosecutors lying and withholding evidence, that trial could have been very different simply because they didn't have the video that we have
now. Right, I agree, yeah.
But
the thing is, I think the prosecutors still need to be charged with something. I guess I don't know the judicial system that much because I'm sure – This wasn't an isolated case. You hear about all these stories of people were charged with things that they didn't commit just because whoever wanted to charge someone because maybe it was a horrendous crime, whatever. But the sad thing is, I think in this country we need to, and this is was a good case of that. We need to demand justice, but we need to demand justice that is honest. And if they don't know right away who did it, it's like, don't push them to charge someone just to charge them because you want to wash your hands of it. You know why? Because the thing is, the person that goes to jail possibly that never did it, okay, that's awful in itself. But then you still have the person out there that did do it.
Yeah, I'm trying some stuff down here. Yeah. Well, and that's the thing, too.
It's so sad because I would hope that if someone I know, or even if I'd ever get into that position, because you don't know, you could get charged with something you had nothing to do with it by how they do illegal things or non-truthful things. You could be spend the rest of your life in jail.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And you could,
you could say,
well, I don't hang around with those type of people, or I don't do that stuff. Well, some of these people didn't do that stuff either, and they just looked like the other person.
Well, there's a lot of – there's two things. I got a comment here. I just checked live chat. Sirik 414 left a comment for us I want to get to in just a second. So hang on, and we'll get to this. But there's two things that have changed a lot in criminal law. One of them is video, which is now being allowed. And you know, that's the first thing. And the second thing is DNA. And so there's a lot of people falsely accused – that are being, you know, let out of jail after decades. There were two people that were accused of the assassination of Malcolm X. that were finally exonerated. I don't know if it was DNA or not, but they finally got out after decades of, like, you know, 30, 40 years of being in jail for no reason. So they were innocent. And so people forget. This is why I've never been for the death penalty. And, you know, conservatives, you know, yell at me, well, we should kill the murderers. I said, great, but how do you know they're the murderers? You know, unless there's certain cases that are cut and dried. I mean, I wouldn't mind if Daryl Brooks, found guilty, were executed, because it's pretty clear he did it. You know, I don't think there's really any doubt as far as that goes. The video proved it. The officer saw him. The eyewitnesses proved it. It's his vehicle, the DNA, the forensic evidence. I hate to say this. This is where it gets gruesome. But the evidence from his vehicle of who he hit is still there. You know, and so that's been impounded. That's being checked. So I don't think it's going to be tough to prove that he did it. Okay. Those aren't the cases I'm talking about. But my friend Jeffrey Descovich, who was arrested at 17, falsely accused of rape and murder, and spent 16 years in jail for nothing. All right. He didn't do it. And eventually, I think it was DNA
that's
that got him out.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Yeah. Yeah.
No,
see,
but can you imagine? I mean, that is
yeah,
just
I can.
Horrible. Wow. And especially as a guy. You know, I think mm-hmm. as a female, and I shouldn't be prejudiced, but I think as a female, we don't – that doesn't happen as often. But, man, yeah. Yeah, especially with the rape,
well,
it's like, wow, how, yeah, and that can totally destroy someone's life.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's interesting is that there is in inequality and inequity in the judicial proceedings. Black men get longer sentences than white men. Women get lesser sentences and fewer convictions than men. I mean, they're just certainly, if you look at trends now, does that mean women commit less crimes? I don't think so. But women statistically have a better chance of not being arrested, not going to trial, and not being convicted. Right? And that's the reality of the judicial system. I guess people, the perception is they don't think women can do some of these things until you find some horrendous woman that murdered, like, you know, her kids or someone else or something like that. So there are, quote, inequities. But I don't want to go by that. I want to go by each case individually. And so if you toss out race and sex and you just go by the crime itself and the person that did it, that's the only way this should go. But the two things that are the most significant right now, I think, in criminal law are video and DNA. And this is why I've always been against the death penalty, because you keep hearing about these cases of people, you know, 10, 20, 30 years in jail. And it turns out they were right all along. They didn't do it. They were right. They didn't do it. And so the Innocence Project and Jeffrey Descovich's, you know, project and some of these other projects out there to free these people. The Constitution, you know, the rights of the accused, it's not there to put the guilty in jail. It's to protect the innocent from going to jail. You know, and if you carry an execution, and you discover 5 years later that you were wrong, the state was wrong, you can't bring that person back. I mean, it's bad enough to lose 10, 20, or 30
right.
or 40 years of your life, but at least you have some of it left. And at least you can do something and reform the system and write your book and have your movie made and get your story out there and make sure that it doesn't happen to other people. You can still have a productive life, hopefully, you know, depending on how old you are, if you're wrongly accused. But if you're executed, you can't. I mean, nobody cares
right.
if murderers
well,
are executed. Nobody cares, all right? But you care if an innocent person is executed, because that should never happen. Never.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's
yeah.
true. That's true. And I think in this country, we've gone mm-hmm. away from being innocent until proven guilty. You know,
yeah.
they're proven guilty right away. And
well,
you know,
that's
for
political.
Some, like what happened over the weekend, obviously mm-hmm. that's, yeah, that there's no question about that. But some other things, it's like, we really do need to wait until all the facts are out, because sometimes looks aren't always as things really are. And
yeah.
yeah.
And libel and slander laws apply. Yeah, libel
yeah.
and slander. You know, in other words, if you can, public figures, you know, you can say things about public figures. There's a higher standard for libel and slander, because you can make really sarcastic, derogatory comments against public figures, but you just can't threaten them. you can't make death threats. You can't make assault threats. You can't make things like that. But you can say, you know, if you think the president's a jerk, you can say the president's a jerk. You know, I can say that Brandon is an insurrection. He has no business being there. You know, that's not slander or libel. That's under investigation. All right. And even if it weren't under investigation, I say that he has no business being there. But anybody that threatens the president, that's a felony. You don't do that. Okay, so there are places you can go and places you can't go. But, you know, you can slander an individual if they're not a public figure. It's a lower standard of slander, you know. I mean, but if you're telling the truth about somebody, that's a defense. If someone accuses you of slander, but you've told the truth, that Thief in Chief Brandon did steal the election, and here's the forensic evidence, and here are the court cases that didn't get taken up, and here's the stuff that sat before the Supreme Court, and here's the hours and hours and hours that Rudy Giuliani and Jenna Ellis presented to all the state legislatures, and here are the forensic audits by the Cyber Ninjas and Dr. Shiva and all the other folks that did that, and here, you know, here's what we found, here's fake registrations, and here's the result of the canvas, you know. We can say that he stole the election. I mean, it's pretty obvious. Anyway, let's get to Sirik. Oh, I got it. Looks like S-E-E-R-I-K 414, who says a federal judge ordered two lawyers to pay $187,000 for filing a frivolous election lawsuit. There's a lot of implications here we don't know about. It looks like Dave is not able to join us today, so we'll just obviously we're going 40 minutes into what, you know, his usual visit, but we'll get him next week. Anyway, so Santa Rosa Volunteers, great organization. In fact, they're so busy they can't call my show. Okay, that's fine. All right. So Sirik 414 says a federal judge just ordered two lawyers to pay $187,000 for filing a frivolous election lawsuit. Gene, what's your reaction to that? Because I have several things that that immediately come to mind.
Well, the thing is, I don't know enough about it to even say it. I mean, I don't. Where was it at? What's frivolous? What makes it frivolous?
Mm-hmm. There you go. Now you get onto it. So first of all, a federal judge, you know, they're implying that that's somehow a lofty position of authority and they should be doing the correct thing. Well, maybe yes, maybe no. I mean, I've seen the Supreme Court screw up all the time. The Supreme Court was constitutionally bound to take the Texas election case and they didn't. So they failed. They acted illegally and they all should have been removed for bad behavior for not taking the Texas election case. That's what the Constitution says. It's not a lifetime term. It's good behavior. And that was bad behavior. Then it says just ordered two lawyers to pay $187,000 for filing a frivolous election lawsuit. Okay, so election lawsuit, that's interesting. Okay, so we know there was fraud. We know there was fraud, massive fraud. We know that many states are going to be doing audits. We know that Wisconsin's already filed a resolution to disqualify and decertify the Biden electors and replace them with – I don't know if they're replacing them with Trump electors. Or I think they are, actually. Or at least they're getting rid of the Biden electors. So Biden would lose, you know, 10 of his fraudulent electoral votes. Okay, so that's a good thing. That's not frivolous. That's huge. So when Sirik 414 says, you know, filing a frivolous election lawsuit, what makes it frivolous? That's what I want to know. You know, if they are basing it on any kind of evidence they've developed in terms of canvassing, in terms of multiple votes, ballot harvesting, mail vote fraud, testimony, affidavits, you know, actual forensic evidence of the ballots themselves, you know, signatures that weren't verified, ballots that appear to be, multiple types, the mail-in ballots that weren't folded, because mail-in ballots have to be folded, you know, all these different things can prove fraud, election fraud. So saying it's frivolous, now does that mean the judge is a coward and didn't want to take up the case? Which seems to be what's happening all over, that it's not that the evidence is bad, it's that they're not even looking at it. So is this another case of where a federal judge refused to do their duty, to do their constitutionally bound duty and look at the evidence before declaring something frivolous, or did they just declare it frivolous because they don't want to deal with it because they're a coward? So those are things we need to answer. So Sirik 414, if you want to make further comments, that's what we need to know. So you know, this is a real thing, or is this just is this a judge trying to skirt their duty and skip the constitutional responsibility?
Yeah, because I would like to read the lawsuit too that was thrown that was called frivolous, because yeah, that would be very interesting. Because bottom line is this: I can't see a lawyer wasting their time writing up a frivolous lawsuit and something like that. You think they've got a lot other things to do?
Yeah. Well, in these times of racial strife and turmoil, I'm going to play one more piece here because we're going to have a little bit of fun before Dave gets here. This is my piece on the January white sale. And so you may think this is racist, and if you do, I don't care because you're wrong. This is really against white liberals more than anything else. So let me play this piece and hope you enjoy it. Another one of those things I did while I was locked down from last year. And we'll be right back. Here it is, America, the answer to riots, brutality, and all our racial problems, the return of the January white sale. Are you a guilt-ridden white person? Are you a person of no color? Do you want to finally assuage that guilt for slavery, the Civil War, the KKK, and black people sitting at the back of the bus? Well, here is your long-awaited answer. The Black Lives Matter Department of Reparations has come up with the perfect solution.
the return of the January white sale. Now, in years past, this was a big deal. After Christmas, sheets, towels, pillowcases, and other white linens were sold with their biggest discount of the year. In today's new normal world, however, things are going to be very different, because Black Lives Matter is changing the original white sale, and now they are actually going to be auctioning off and selling white people. You, white, guilt-ridden, ashamed of your whiteness, complete cowards, bowing your heads, kneeling, raising your hands like at a revival meeting, you with your eyes cast down, you whimpering liberals hoping to buy your way out of a debt of guilt that can never be fully repaid, because no leftist of color wants you to. You will have the chance to experience what no black person experiences in the United States today. Slavery. Yeah, that's right. Slavery. Isn't this great? You will be on the cutting edge of social justice, and you will save the taxpayers some $14 trillion of reparations national debt. Black Lives Matter has gone to a lot of trouble to erase our history and remake society so guilty white people can finally feel free of their white supremacy. George Soros and Bill Gates have already created the Venture Capital Fund to establish Race Bait Consulting, Incorporated, which will be handling the actual white person sale in January. So, who is available for purchase? Oh, and part of the deal is that white people can't be bought by other white people. That would defeat the whole theme of the event. Anyway, to the question. Your basic rifle on the pickup truck, racist, sexist, Islamophobe, Neanderthal, redneck male, is probably not going to sit around and be put in an auction, even if they will be well cared for by their new owners. What we will have available are liberal, surrendering, grilly man metrosexuals and emotionally distraught and disillusioned feminists, both of whom have already knelt before a designated agent of Black Lives Matter to confess their white privilege. So how do you guilt-ridden white people sign up for the January white sale? It's easy. Contact your local chapter of Black Lives Matter, show up at a rally with a flag saying, "Take me for the January white sale," or simply sign up at the next mass kneeling confession of white privilege coming to a neighborhood near you. The new January white sale is made possible by a grant from Race Bait Industries, Incorporated, and put on by the new normal, new improved Black Lives Matter.
Who says we don't have fun here? Politically incorrect? We've redefined the term, I think. Yeah. Pianki, good morning, sir. How are you today?
Good morning. How are you?
Oh, I'm having a great time. I just played my January white sale. I mean, that is guaranteed to get me called a racist. Hey, Gina, have you heard that before? I don't know if you have.
Yes, I have, yeah.
Oh, okay, good. All right. Yeah. Anyway. So, Pianki, what's on your mind?
They had me patting my feet.
What's that?
They had me patting my foot. Sounds good.
It is kind of toe-tapping. Well, I try to make my sarcastic pieces interesting. I haven't done one for a while. I don't know. There's something about the lockdown that just inspired me to just, you know, be holed up here in the room and get out the Adobe Audition stuff and start writing and getting soundtracks and, you know, putting these all together. It's fun. I still want to do my one on Billy Bob's artificial truck noise for, wimpy girly men that want to have an electric truck sound like a real one. So I'll get that one. That's coming someday, maybe. So we get to a little bit of time go ahead, yeah.
You made mention about the tragic thing that happened in the Thanksgiving parade and the individual that done it.
Daryl Brooks.
And how they are being treated so privilegedly.
Mm-hmm.
And how the news is treating it privilegedly. And how when you look back into this individual's past, how they have been treated privilegedly. That allow them to come back over and over again. It caused people suffering and pain. And it just goes to show how things have evolved and turned into, especially when it comes to news media and even to some justice systems, departments of the cities that was involved, their prosecutors. They didn't do the job that they are supposed to do, or they would have done if it was a white person.
Well, here's a question, though. Are they letting, you know, the left doesn't want bail. They don't want criminal sentences. They're promoting looting in San Francisco and different places in California. Are they tossing white perps out on ridiculously low or no bails, or are they just targeting, you know, black, Hispanic, folks to be, you know, traditionally oppressed minorities in this country? You know, are they the ones who are having their bails cut to nothing and being, you know, released back on the street after running over their, you know, their you know, girlfriend's, you know, mother of their child, like Daryl Brooks did.
I don't think it's even in Spanish. I think it's in blacks giving them privilege.
All right,
if you're out in L.A., if you're out in L.A., most of your car chases are people trying to head to Mexico. They will chase you to Higgs Inn to get you. The helicopter pursuits and so on and so on and so on. The thing to watch, the case to watch is this case in Texas with this shooting with this 18-year-old black child that was in a fight and went out and got a gun out of his book bag. And see, there should be accountability. Should the school district be sued because they permitted a gun to become to come into the school? Hey, wait a minute. How about this Thanksgiving parade? Should Ford Motor Company be brought into a lawsuit because the perpetrator used a Ford SUV? They want to sue Remington for the ammunition. They want to sue Glock for the gun they made.
Yeah, but they're not trying to get rid of Ford trucks. They're trying to get rid of guns. I mean, obviously, there's a difference there, but I know what your point is. It makes a lot of sense. But let's get back to the other one, the fact that he had a – I didn't know he carried a gun with him to school. You know, students – you know, the thing is –
Oh, yeah. Ms. Simpson.
Yeah.
Yeah, he premeditatively, after he got through tossing the smaller child around, he premeditatively went out and got a gun out of his book bag. Now, I don't know if he went to his car or he got it. It was already in the school. But I think it was already in the school. And he came back. So, he shot the young the person he was fighting. Then he shot some people that had nothing to do with it.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, teachers should be allowed to carry guns in school. And we have this weird perception that, you know, there's certain places where guns shouldn't be carried by law-abiding citizens, churches, schools, you know, libraries, banks, you know, whatever. It doesn't matter, whatever the place du jour. But students, you know, students are still minors. You know, students cannot bring guns to school. I mean, it's that simple. So I don't have a problem with checking students, you know. But, you know, these things don't seem to happen in private schools. It's always government schools where these things happen. And so I think that the government schools need to do a better job. And I don't know, you know, whether want to target students for random searches. I don't know if you can. I don't know how exactly to do that. Metal detectors at the gates. You know, there's an idea. But I mean, kids are going to bring metal, you know, to their. What if they bring a can opener for you know their lunch or something? I mean, you know, it's kind of a crazy thing. But I think, you know, now was this person have disciplinary problems before? Is this a case where they might have wanted to search his backpack? Just because he's got prior disciplinary issues? I mean, I don't know. Do you know the history of Simpson and his name is, right?
Yeah, they have metal detectors for students to walk through as they come into the school every morning.
Okay.
And apparently
so how do you get past?
Get past all that.
So how do they get past then?
I don't know. I don't know how he got past it, but he did. The gun was used. And here's the thing. Well, who's going to be held accountable? You had another case here where the FBI, the government paying, in that other school incident, they're paying victims $187 million, I believe it is.
Which school is this?
It was another incident, and I can't think of the name of it. Where the FBI supposedly had information or something on somebody and they didn't act on it, then the person ended up killing people. Well, the same thing with this kid in the...
Well, let's wrestle. I want to wrestle with the topic with you for a little bit here because, you know, we have rights of the accused. We have innocent until proven guilty. We have privacy, you know, but on the other hand, we want to... obviously, if we can prevent a tragedy from happening, we want to do that. And the response has been the wrong thing. Red flag laws, where you take guns away from people from what they might do. But the students that are doing this are usually former students. They're having access to guns in their parents' house, or they're stealing them, which is a crime itself too. And so at what point, you know, do you intervene? Where, you know, where is the line? Where you can start to do something with a student, former student, or someone you think. And let's talk about school shootings in particular. They are particularly heinous because the school is not a place you would expect this kind of thing to happen. It's bad enough in a shopping mall and other places, but schools, you got kids. And so we want to try and protect our kids. So at what point do you intervene with somebody and how do you do it if you want to stop someone from potentially shooting a school without violating the rights of everybody else and that person too?
The parents are supposed to keep the guns and weapons away from the children. So they would be the first one where the accountability is established. Now, if the parents don't do that, are they up for lawsuit too?
I think they are. I know in California, I don't know what the Florida law is, but if you don't keep your guns secure in California, you can be arrested. If your kids just, you know, get a hold of them, they don't even have to do anything with them.
But
the kids are in position
Gene? I'm thinking that would be, I mean, I get it that the parents need to be held accountable, but I think it's to a point because as a, you know, let's say me as a child, I knew where my dad, my mom, whoever, where they keep their key to the gun safe, whatever. And I go get a gun out. I mean, the parents did the right thing. They had the guns locked up or they had them securely put away. But if a child can still get in there, how much or how far does that go? Because, you know, where are you going to keep the key on your body at all times? You know what I'm saying? And so it's like, I get it that the parents need to be more responsible, but it's individual. I mean, I don't care what age you are, you know, as a child, unless you're watching them 24 hours a day, you still may miss things.
Yeah. I used to have a gun safe, a big one, that had a combination lock. You know, of course, I didn't tell my kid the combination. And the door handle, you could take off. You know, even if you could get the combination, if you guessed it, which you wouldn't. But the door handle came off, and I could put that up in a high place, too, you know, when you're way above the safe. So there are ways to do it. You don't have to have a key. There are other ways to do it. But the best protection is to teach your kid, or in my case, I bored my kid to death with guns. Like, oh, you want to look at the guns? No, I'm sick of looking at the guns. You know, so I use reverse psychology. So there's no mystery to her. She wanted to look at the gun, she could. It was no big deal. But, you know, teaching kids, what's that?
Another thing in this this school shooting, the parents said that the Simpson had been bullied all year long. Well, then, if that's the case, then the parents or the school should have put better measures in place in order to prevent the further bullying that led to the escalation that resulted in the shooting. So,
yeah, but you're still responsible for shooting. I don't care how much you're bullied. Yeah, being bullied is not an excuse to shoot anybody, but it is something that can be used as a prevention measure, absolutely. Jean?
The thing is, though, when you're being bullied, sometimes you get, because I just know from talking to kids, sometimes they don't know what else to do. They're so run down of being bullied and nobody listening to them. They feel it. There's no, you know, not shooting, but I can see where they could get to the point where they feel there's no other way. Nobody else is going to do anything, so I'm going to take life into my own hands. And do I say it's right? Heck no. But the thing is, we need to do better as adults to watch these kids when someone says something about bullying, and for all this stuff that goes on in the schools with bullying or about bullying, you can have auditoriums and have people come in and talk about bullying. But when the shit hits the fan and a kid goes to a teacher, to the principal and says, I'm being bullied, how many of those adults really take that child seriously and do something about it?
Oh, that's a good question. I would say, Mike, I'll give you a personal example here. When I came to this country, I came here with an Australian accent. The entire school made fun of me. I was bullied by a whole bunch of people. I felt totally depressed and disgusted, and I really hated this country when I first got here because the treatment I got was miserable. Now, did I go do violent things and destroy property and, you know, beat people over the head with baseball bats and things like that? No. I got creative. I became a musician. You know, but that's an unusual reaction, I think. So I found things that I did that made me happy. You know, so I just got away from it and just tried to survive the experience in school as best I could. But I understand bullying like few people do.
Yeah.
It's part of what makes me fearless now. But, you know, yeah. So but people react differently. They get depressed. There are people who have committed suicide for far less than has happened to me and has happened to a lot of other people. You know, so there's two ways that people hurt themselves or they hurt somebody else. both of those are wrong and need to be prevented as much as possible. Well, you know, but teachers don't listen. Guidance counselors don't listen. My parents didn't listen. I was on my own. I mean, I know what it's like to be a minority of one in a strange country, you know, in a strange school system, you know, with no help from anybody, but still survive all that and not, you know, do all the things to hurt myself or anybody else. So it can be done. And there are people that had a lot worse situations than me.
You had more, how would you say, more abilities to do that yourself, but everybody is in a different situation. And I had a friend, she's a psych person, and she worked in a state hospital where they were the ones to help decide whether or not murderers get put back on the streets. And she used to say, we're all one decision away from being that person. Yeah. And that is so true. It's easy for us to sit back and say, oh, we would never do that. When you get to the desperation point where you feel there's no other way out, when you're just sick and tired of something, we do not do things that are the wisest, best decision. And as a child, they don't have the frontal lobe developed to make a lot of wise, good decisions all the time. And so
when does that happen?
It's just to the fact that when I was a kid, I mean, you got teased, but I mean, when I went to school, I got teased about my shoes, whatever. I could care less. But some people, if they would have been the same thing, that could have tore them apart. And I think now some people just want to fit in. I mean, I think there's just so much stuff. And I think with social media, that makes things worse, because if you're on Facebook or wherever, kids aren't even on Facebook, wherever they're at, and how they could be bullied on there. So right away, it's just like we didn't have Facebook as a kid, and so I didn't have technology as a kid, you know? And so it's like we're living in different times.
This kid's parents bought him a $30,000 vehicle, and he's in high school. He had gold teeth and also a diamond earring.
He's privileged.
Yes. The kid he was fighting was much smaller than him. He picked him. He threw him out of the way. Then he left out the classroom, went and got the pistol, and came back. When he threw him out of the way, at that point, he was no more a threat. He's much smaller than him. He's younger. He was 3 years younger than him.
It's just sad. When you talk about that, some people, parents, what they do, they think money can buy things, meaning money can buy their child's happiness. And it can't. It doesn't always. Sometimes what the child needs is actual, and I can't say for this kid, but I'm talking, sometimes what a child needs instead of the next best thing, a new car, whatever. I know a kid that had a Hummer when he didn't even have a driver's license, but he got it. His parents got it for him as a status symbol for the school they played against in football, in high school. And so the thing is, but some of these kids, all they want is someone to love them, someone to spend time with them, someone to listen to them. Now, I don't know this kid. I don't know anything about the whole situation. But the thing is, it's like we just don't know.
Well, the story is not being true is the thing. And then on the other hand, you got idiots out here that still, on the Kyle Rittenhouse case, use an excuse that his mother drove him across state line. He had an illegal gun.
Funny you should say that. We've got
after the verdict, and they still using that argument. That just goes to show you the extent of ignorance that exists amongst the public in this country.
We've got our next guest, Dave Schneier, on the line right now. So it's a good thing. This is a good time to bring him on. I've been sort of thinking, I'd love him listening for a couple minutes here. So let me introduce Dave again. Dave has been on the show before. He was one of our youngest reporters ever to come on the show. And we were talking education way back when. He's homeschooled. He's got his own YouTube channel now. He's got some opinions. And he just put out a video on the Kyle Rittenhouse trial. So I want to bring him on now at this point. And let's chat a little bit and let's hear his story. And you guys, of course, you know, Pianki, Gene, feel free, please stick around. Or Gene, obviously. But Pianki, feel free to stick around for a while. And let's talk. We got the rest of the hour here to sort of hash over this and any other issue with one of my favorite young reporters here on Action Radio. Dave, how you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm a great time. How you been the last? How long has it been since you've been on? About a year or so, or 2 years, or I don't know when did we first get that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just busy with school now, but yeah.
Okay. So where are you in school? Are you graduating soon, or high school, or what?
I'm a junior right now. I go to PCA, so it's a pretty good school. I really like it.
Yeah. Private school, right?
Yeah.
So you've not been a victim of the government school indoctrination at this point?
No, I went to public school for elementary and it was great. And then I went to public school for sixth grade. And it was not so great. So after that, my parents just decided to put me in private school. So I've been in private school or between private and homeschool for the rest of that time.
Yeah. Here's the thing too. Even with government schools, parents, you know, they can teach their kids all kinds of stuff. You know, I just happen to be naturally curious, folks. The best thing they ever did for me was gave me the World Book Encyclopedia, the internet of its day. You know, back in the 60s, and I plowed through that all of them, you know, for years, you know, so you know, became like a little, I could be a Jeopardy contestant by the time I was done with it. But it was really fascinating, so I love learning stuff. School unfortunately took away my desire to learn for several years after college. I never wanted to pick up a book. I never wanted to you know, read something else, because I read so much and had so much that I did and just worked so hard at all the papers and things. I got disgusted with it. It's like, yeah, don't want to do this anymore. All right. Pianki Fort has left us, but hopefully he'll come back and join. He's probably just listening in somewhere. Anyway, so tell me about your YouTube project, and then let's get into your views on the Kyle Rittenhouse trial, which Gene and I and Pianki and other people have been talking about since the verdict came out. So let's hear your story, young reporter.
Yeah, well, I think it was probably about in 2018, I think, you know, I had a lot of political opinions, and so I just thought I'd make a YouTube channel to, you know, just make some videos about what I believe in, you know, try to spark some conversation, change some people's minds, you know. And so that's what I did. And it's been not always consistently active uploading, but, you know, I try to get in a video at least one every couple of months now, but I think I'll be more actively uploading. I'm just kind of more getting the inspiration to do it. But, I have around 190 subscribers, so it's been consistently growing.
The most recent we have a video page here. In fact, I post your video on my Facebook page, but I'm putting it right now on the Action Radio video page. And so if you haven't joined, I'll probably skip over that in a second and send you an invite so you can do that too. This is for anybody who makes their own videos. This isn't for posting everybody else's videos, but if you have your own, then it's worth doing that. So let me just send you an invite while I'm talking here. So yeah, so you've been doing the project for a while. Is it more of a reporting kind of video project or commentary or both?
Probably more commentary. For instance, with the Kyle Rittenhouse thing, the main point of it was to get it was an editorial. The main point of it was to get my view across. So I did, you know, lay down the ground story just so people, you know, for people who didn't know what happened, for people to know what happened.
Yeah, makes sense. Okay,
but,
well, tell us the story.
It's just like
what happened? Let's get into some of the commentary.
Yeah. So, you know, I just started off laying the groundwork, you know, like he already had gotten the gun in Illinois and Wisconsin. I mean, it didn't cross state lines, you know. He was already, like, spent the night there before, so it wasn't that his mom drove him to go to that thing. He was just there to do medical work and to protect property. And then these Antifa thugs just start attacking him randomly.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's what happened. And so when he had to shoot, he didn't want to shoot, but it was self-defense. And so this, the fact that he was prosecuted to begin with, to me, is just completely unacceptable. Because if anyone looks at the video, it's obviously self-defense. I mean, this is so blatantly self-defense. I mean, there's no, I mean, it's textbook self-defense. They have a mob surrounding you, threatening to kill you, so then, and they're trying to attack you, so then you shoot in self-defense. I mean, there's nothing more self-defense than that.
Yeah, Let's. I want to
also another
thing. Hold on a second. I want to sort of take these points as we get to them, otherwise they get lost. But you talk about the gun. Yeah. The gun's been a source of controversy. The leftists make up, you know, whatever story they want. Media were saying things like he crossed state lines and he shouldn't have had a gun, and you know, he obtained it illegally. So whose gun is it? Is it his gun? And can he own one in Wisconsin?
No, it was not his gun. I believe it was a friend's gun.
Okay, so he borrows a gun, and that's fine in Wisconsin.
He's given a gun, I think. It might have been given to him, but it was given to him by a friend in Wisconsin. So he did not.
So 17-year-old possessing an AR-15.
It's legal, because in Wisconsin minors can possess guns as long as they're long barrel guns.
As long as it's
not a short barrel gun. That's why he wasn't charged with the weapons charge.
Now, wait a minute. So let's talk about this for a second, because the prosecution tried to do that. They tried to say that he had a dangerous weapon. A weapons are always dangerous. That's what makes them weapons. So what the hell is a dangerous weapon?
I don't know, but what I do know is they ended up dropping the charge because it wasn't standing up. So they ended up dropping that against him. So for anyone who still thinks that the weapons controversy is even a controversy, then they're just ignoring what the prosecution did themselves.
Yeah. I mean, but it's an absurd. It's like, you know, when they call something an assault weapon. I mean, weapons are designed to do that. Otherwise, it's not a weapon. What makes a weapon intimidating is the fact that it can kill you if you do something stupid, like try and kill me.
Yeah.
You know, that's what makes it a weapon. You can hunt with it, target shoot with it. You can do all kinds of things with it. But the point is that it fires a bullet. You know, a firearm fires a bullet. And a rifle fires a bullet, you know, more accurately in a longer distance than a handgun. And so the point of having one, you know, for self-defense is that it works. You know, it's an excellent weapon for self-defense, which makes sense. Now, can it be used offensively by criminals? Sure it can, but that's not what we're talking about here. This is clearly self-defense. But I want to get the gun thing out of the way because do you think the fact that it was an AR-15, that there's a prejudice built up by the left in terms of assault weapons, which I call freedom rifles, by the way. So do you think that there's a prejudice against freedom rifles in the case, and that was part of why the prosecution brought the weapons charge? What do you think?
Definitely. I've heard people say, like online and stuff, that, he's bringing a military-grade weapon to a protest. So definitely, yeah, there definitely is a bias.
Military-grade weapon.
What's
a military-grade weapon? I'm just curious. I remember seeing that.
It's a weapon that's used by the military, and last time I checked, AR-15s are not used by the U.S. military.
No, M16s are, which fire bursts or fully automatic fire. They're select fire. Now, they are truly what you would call an assault rifle, I guess, under the term of the original, the German, the Sturmgewehr, the original Sturmgewehr 42, which was the first semi-automatic, medium caliber, you know, first fully automatic, select fire. It could fire single shot or it could fire, you know, until the magazine's empty. That was the original, what people are calling an assault rifle. You know, under a military term of a weapon that can, it's selective fire. You can fire one bullet, you can fire all the bullets, you know, and that's where this all started. So the AR-15 is a single shot rifle. It fires one, in terms of semi-automatic, in other words, it fires one shot at a time. All semi-auto means is it loads itself, auto, self.
Yeah.
Okay, it's from Latin, right? So it is a self-loading gun where you fire it once, and the bolt goes back, it ejects the old cartridge, and loads a fresh one. And that's it. And it won't fire until you pull the trigger again.
Okay.
Same thing with a revolver, which fires when you pull the trigger, except that manually turns a cylinder and pulls a hammer back and things like that. Oh, by the way, revolvers are military-grade weapons. Revolvers have been in the military since we had revolvers. Okay. You know, the 1911 pistol, the .45 caliber pistol, is a military-grade weapon. It's also very commonly used in self-defense, as is the M9 Beretta, a military-grade weapon, which is also used in self-defense and target things like that. So so let's get this military-grade, you know, that's like assault
weapon. Also, can I add something to that?
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, just building a little bit on the idea of, like, a military-grade weapon makes it any less valid. You know, the Second Amendment, you know, last time I checked, says the right to bear arms shall not be infringed. So there's nothing in there that's, like, unless it's a military-grade weapon.
Yeah. Well, here's another one, too. And I was talking about this in terms of the Florida laws. you know, where they had the Parents' Bill of Rights, unless subject to law, you know. And I said, wait a minute, the Second Amendment doesn't say, you know, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed except by law, you know, because that would be absurd.
Yeah.
But here's the other part of the Second Amendment that's worth talking about, too. And Gene, don't feel left out. You want to jump in here, feel free. Both of us talk fast. So Dave and I, this is why it gets kind of exciting around here. But the Second Amendment says, you know, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. Well-regulated in 1700 meant well-equipped, well-armed, like regulars. And regulars were what they called infantry soldiers. So if you were regulated, it means you had the same arms as an infantry soldier, which was, last time I looked, military grade. Okay? So
yeah.
So in fact, you're actually the Second Amendment not only says the government can't infringe upon you, but it actually says that it's necessary for you to be of military grade, which is kind of interesting. Yeah. Here's a question for you. This is purely theoretical, and this is something that I think I'm the only person that's ever raised this issue, where it says a well-regulated militia is necessary to the security of a free state. Now, do you think of free state as geographical, in other words, Connecticut or California? Or Colorado, I'm going through the C states. Is free state a geographical or is it a condition? In other words, to maintain a state of freedom, a state like hunger is a state, like cold is a state, a state, in other words, a condition. So in other words, when the Second Amendment says a well-regulated militia, in other words, you know, the same thing that an infantry soldier carries, you know, in their arms, you know, bearing arms, a single person, a well-regulated militia of basically a citizen army is necessary for the security of a free state, are they talking about a state of freedom geographically or conditionally or both? How's that for you?
I would say it's a mix of both. So I guess there's two parts to it. So with the state of condition, the founding fathers, you know, were very into checks and balances. And so I like to view the Second Amendment as a check and balance, partly as a check and balance against government tyranny. James Madison, to paraphrase, wrote that the federal army should never be larger, unless in a time of war, than one-fifth the size of the militias. So the founding fathers did not want like a concentration of military power within one single entity, because that is just a recipe for tyranny.
You know, it's interesting you say that.
They wanted.
I put forward a principle I call defense equality. In other words, no unit of the government, be it the army, be it the local police department, be it anything in between, should ever be better armed than the people within that jurisdiction.
Yeah.
Okay. So in other words, the army domestically should, I mean, foreign is different. If they're going to fight foreign wars, they have to be better armed. I hope so. Okay.
Yeah.
But domestically, you know, domestic armies within the United States should not be better armed than the civilian U.S. population. The D.C. police should not be better armed than the residents of D.C. You know, the people, in other words, if you're a deterrent, if you believe in citizen authority over the military and over the police, then the people, in order to avoid tyranny, should be at least as well armed or better than the government. Because the government serves people. They are public servants. So they are not public supremacists. You know, and so the idea that the police can have automatic weapons and the people can't. The police can have all kinds of different weapons and the people can't. That, to me, violates the principle of defense equality. And, of course, then the argument comes out, but Greg, you know, people with a machine gun can kill a lot of people. Yeah, but that's a criminal act. And I'm not talking about criminal acts. And criminal acts are not covered by the Second Amendment, which brings up the next point is, do you see the Second Amendment as I do when it says the right of the people to keep and bear arms means keep and bear? It doesn't mean use. Using arms is an entirely different proposition. What do you think?
No, totally. Well, the I believe 14th Amendment that you can lose your rights by trial by jury. So if you're a convicted felon, it might not be the 14th. One of those Reconstruction.
I think it's the fourth. Yeah. Well, I got a constitution. I need to refer back to it, which I do frequently. Because my memory sucks.
Well, anyways, so you can lose your rights. If you're a convicted felon, basically. And so if you're committing – yes, you know what I mean? It's definitely the right to, you know, keep and bear arms. I mean, you don't have a right to use it however you want. Nobody's arguing for that. I hope that's not what the people on the left think that we believe.
But that's the argument, though. That is exactly what I'm arguing, that the left will say
yeah.
you can't allow people to have machine guns because they might kill a lot of people. Well, that's a criminal
yeah.
use, and that's already illegal.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so
yeah.
so the point I'm trying to make is that the Second Amendment, mm-hmm. the right to keep and bear is absolute. Okay, you can't
yes.
say something's an assault weapon. You can't say something's military grade. You can't disqualify it. You can't have reasonable restrictions, as the Heller decision said. You can't have
yeah.
a compelling state interest. You can't have public safety be a justification for denying people the use of arms individually, unless they violate. Laws for things that you can't do, brandishing, extortion, murder,
yeah.
carjacking, all those kind of things that people do illegally mm-hmm. with firearms, takes that right away. But unless you believe in prior
restraint, I'd like to ask you.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm on
I'd like
to
ask you something, maybe slipping in a little, not slipping back at you, but what would mm-hmm. you say about people who are severely mentally ill, like dealing with severe depression, have a history of anger issues, but not necessarily like an actual criminal record?
That's a really great question. Because I know that goes into red flag laws. It goes to prior restraint. And so the best way I can answer that, because I don't have a perfect answer yet, my thing would be if you are, can you be deprived of rights if due process has been done? If you've been, I think the firearms registration form says, if you've been adjudicated mentally deficient. So in other words, you've been to a hospital, you've been through doctors. This is where Gene can help us out here. You've been certified by a judge to be, someone that shouldn't do it. Can you deny right of firearms? That's not a bad question. I would say probably, but in the same way, if you're going to deny firearms, wait a minute, hold on. If you're going to deny firearms, you also have to deny vehicles. You have to be, in some kind of care. You have to be under somebody's, guardianship. At that point, if you're mentally incompetent to carry firearms, you're also mentally incompetent to take care of yourself. So in other words, at the point at which you cannot exercise properly your firearms rights, your travel rights, which is what I call driving, various other rights, at that point, that's the situation. But the idea of someone being depressed, being denied their firearms rights when they have the right to chainsaws, Molotov cocktails, poisons, vehicles, steak knives,
yeah.
everything else, that doesn't make any sense to me. So that's where I draw the line.
Right.
If you're mentally incompetent to live on your own in society, then you've had your due process. Okay. And at that point, but if you're going to deny firearms, then you have to deny vehicles. You have to deny other things like that. And at that point I'd say yes, but otherwise no, unless you commit a crime.
Okay.
And this is something that's really important too. This is the concept of prior restraint, and the whole idea of prior restraint in a free society. Yes, we don't accuse people, take their rights away until they commit a crime. Well, why do you do that? Well, to protect the honest people. The whole point is to protect the honest people from losing their rights. And the only way to protect the honest people from losing their rights is not to take away the rights of anybody until they've abused their rights in a criminal action. Make sense? That's why I say it that way.
Yep.
Okay. More questions? This is fun. Go ahead. Ask me anything. I kind of enjoy it.
I wouldn't mind going back into the Kyle Rittenhouse discussion. Where did we,
okay. I got notes on that too.
I think we left off on
the
issue of the gun, I think.
Okay. What's the next issue?
I think the next issue would be, I think a lot of people bring up that this is the funniest one. So he shouldn't have been there to begin with. He shouldn't have showed up. It was his fault for being there. But
this is the blame the victim, blame the victim accusation. Well, tell me about that. But who's saying that, and what did they say exactly?
I look on Twitter a lot, so a lot of the stuff that I even bring up is just tweets that I've seen. I don't necessarily remember from who or whatever, but people say that. Just random, people on the left. And, it really is, you can be wherever you want on public property. You can walk mm-hmm. around any street that you, you can't tell him that he shouldn't have been there. Not only that, I would go as far to say, not only did he have a right to be there, but I would personally say, and this is just, Davidology, but he didn't do anything wrong by being there, morally speaking. He was not being a bad person by being there and doing what he was doing.
Well, he's being accused of being a vigilante, taking the law into his own hands. And so I looked up the definition of vigilante just out of curiosity. my online dictionary, which is probably not the best, but it said a member of a self-appointed group of citizens, which Kyle was part of, a bunch of people carrying AR-15s. I think people tend to forget that there was a large group of people doing this because they wanted to stop the riots because the police weren't doing their job. Mm-hmm. This is a member of a self-appointed group of citizens who undertake law enforcement in their community without legal authority, typically because the legal agencies are thought to be inadequate. Isn't that the perfect definition for this, for this case?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Well, yeah. I mean, I would argue.
Oh, and Jean wants to get on this. Jean, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, that's a good definition because he wouldn't have been there. They wouldn't have been there, meaning the ones that went with him, if the police would have been doing their job and they would have not allowed the burning to go on the night before.
Yeah.
Yeah, my favorite line from the trial, in fact, this came from from band practice. We were talking about the trial immediately after it happened, the verdict. And our drummer in our band says, you know, my favorite line is when the prosecutor asked Kyle, he says, why did you put out the fires in the dumpsters? And he looks and he says, because they were on fire? You know, like, what kind of an idiot would ask a question that stupid? So that was a great line. My other favorite line from the prosecution of absurdity is when he says, well, if you bring a gun with you, you give up your right to self-defense. Well, isn't the whole purpose of having a gun to actually exercise your right of self-defense? I mean, this guy's a complete moron. Anyway, so the fire comment and the self-defense comment, any reaction to those?
Well, the main reason that he was there wasn't to – the original purpose that he actually went was to just go around and clean up the place and put out fires and stuff and provide medical aid to people because he had a first aid kit. And actually, every single person that he provided medical care for that night was actually an Antifa, Black Lives Matter rioter protester. So he was just there because he cared about – I mean, at least – because I watched the Tucker Carlson interview that you, tagged me in. And what I got from it is that he was just there because he didn't want his community to be on fire. Mm-hmm. He was upset that, you know, it was being burned down. So he went down there to, you know, clean it up, clean up graffiti, protect, you know, specific property that he was asked to protect, that he was invited to go protect. And then to provide first aid. And the only reason that he brought the gun was just for self-defense because the rioters were carrying around guns. Everything about having the gun was self-defense. And there's no offensive.
Yeah. I mean, most people who carry guns don't want to have to use it. But if something happens, we'd rather have it than not have it because those of us that carry concealed. You know, and so I'll carry openly as soon as the Florida law changes. But until it does, you know, I'm kind of stuck with what I can. But I don't want to be the one that's there wishing I had my gun if there's an assassin, a terrorist, a criminal, any kind of whatever the situation. I don't want, you know, I'm someone who would act. I mean, I've done that, as a flight instructor. I've been in emergencies and I handle them, you know, and I'm still here. So thank God, you know, but I don't mind acting. In situations that call for action, you know, I'll be, I haven't been police. Well, actually I was federal law enforcement briefly, but I'm, you know, I don't mind running to the fight, you know, and there's a lot of folks that aren't officially first responders and a lot of people that will run to the fight when most people are running away. So the people that run to the fight, they're the ones who are going to be the concealed carry holders. They're the ones who are going to walk through Kenosha. But Kenosha never had to happen. Like I say, if the police did their job, if the governor did their job, if they actually arrested the rioters, these weren't peaceful protesters. That's the other thing that got left out. How much Antifa and BLM involvement was there? Because I didn't hear a lot of that in the trial. I heard about the backgrounds of the people. One was a pedophile. One was, had a long sheet, and someone else had something else. So these were not good people. That attacked Kyle, but that doesn't matter. That's not necessarily relevant. That may go to their character, but it was their actions that really determined their criminality. But were they registered, certified Antifa? And Black Lives Matter. This is a pretty white town up there in Wisconsin. How much Black Lives Matter involvement?
I don't know if they're like. I don't know if they're officially organized as like a group with them, but I mean that's what they were protesting over. You know, Jacob Blake's. Being, you know, shot by the police. That's what started these riots.
Pianchi, tell me a bit about this before, too. So who's Jacob Blake, and how does that fit into this puzzle?
I don't it's been a while because, you know, this, you know, that happened in 2020. So, and it wasn't like as big as like, you know, the George Floyd thing. So I'm a little fuzzy on the details. I could go look it up, but I think basically what happened was, is that he was running from the police. He went to his car and there was a knife in his car. I believe he picked it up, and at that, the police shot him in the back 7 times. And so they were saying that, you know, because of that, they just had, you know, burned down the city over that. And so that's why I call it, you know, an Antifa Black Lives Matter protest, because that's what, you know,
and did they
sparked.
Expect burning
even
down
if it isn't
the city
officially
to
affiliated.
Change the laws, or what do they expect to happen when they burn down the city? Or they just want to burn down the city?
Yeah.
I mean, how does that,
no, well,
how does
they,
that change?
Yeah, so...
Yeah.
Yeah, well, so the Green Party nominee for president in 2020, vice president in 2020, Angela Walker, posted something, and I think this basically sums up their views. They view the riot as the voice of the voiceless. So basically, if you're like an oppressed class, or if you're protesting on behalf of an oppressed class, you're allowed to riot and destroy property because you're speaking the anger of all these, you know, oppressed groups. And so that's really how they justify, you know, what they do.
Do you, in your school, for example, do you have Black Lives Matter? I think Gene wants to say something, but do you have Black Lives Matter contingents or Antifa? Is there like a student's Antifa group, or do you get pressure, or do you get influence, or is anybody of these different groups talking to students on your campus, for example?
Yeah. Well, you know, I go to a private Christian school in the Deep South, so I, no. wouldn't allow. I don't even think they would allow that. Now, at other public schools, maybe. I don't know. Wouldn't surprise me. At least maybe not here where me and you live, but in other areas, it would not surprise me. But
interesting. Okay. Jean, you had a question?
I was going to say, with Jacob, like, I don't even know if he died. I think he was just paralyzed, but I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
But
he didn't die.
The thing is, I just have a question. With what was going on in Wisconsin, wasn't most of those people not even from there? They just came in there? Well, the three that were shot were from there, but that's just what I was told, and I don't know. So that's why I'm asking. A lot of the people that were protesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I don't know. I could go look it up right now.
No, that's okay.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, again, it wouldn't surprise me, because I do know that a lot of these, like, Antifa protesters do travel from, you know, city to city, a lot of these Black Lives Matter people, so, like, to be professional demonstrators. So it wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, we've also heard
But it's sad when people think that burning things up and destroying buildings is a good way to protest. No, it's not. It's like, whatever happened to peaceful protesting?
Well, this is the thing, too. I mean, a protest, if you're going to accomplish something, you have to have goals. You have to have an agenda. You have to, you know, want something that's within the realm of the possible. You know, if you have a grievance, I'll tell you a peaceful protest. We have them going on right here in Florida. In fact, I spoke at the second, you know, medical freedom rally at Wahoo Stadium, Blue Wahoo Stadium, and that was a peaceful protest. We had a gathering of people. We had people in the audience, you know, in the stands, listening to various doctors, lawyers, and me, you know, speaking. That was a peaceful protest. A week later, a bunch of folks got on a bus and went to Tallahassee for another peaceful protest. You know, I know, because they called us from the bus. You know, this is a week ago Tuesday, you know, on their way there. That was a peaceful protest, but they had a goal, getting rid of vaccine mandates, okay? So the folks that are in Kenosha, you know, if you want to protest Jacob, what was his last name?
Blake.
Jacob, I forgot. Jacob Blake, okay. So if you want to protest that, you have to have a resolution. You have to have something in law that you want to change, or something in the police that you want to change. You have to have a policy that you want to change. And I didn't see any of that. All I saw was people tearing up buildings. No. Riots are different than protests. Riots just want to destroy things, kill people, hurt people, do whatever it is. And it's just an excuse for some folks to go nuts. So it seems to me if the authorities aren't going to do anything, then a vigilante group who wants to maintain order when the police refuse to do so is a very logical, very American, very pro-community thing to do. In fact, they brought a whole bunch of, rifles for self-defense actually makes sense because, you know, Antifa and this other, we've had documentation that these folks, Antifa, you know, and Black Lives Matter can assault. They have vans show up with, you know, baseball bats and bricks and Molotov cocktails and things like that, you know, so they're well-organized, well-armed. And we know that everybody from Kamala Harris, the party girl, you know, currently occupying the White House, and a bunch of George Soros and others will bail them out. they're not prosecuted. They're almost exempt from justice. They have a free pass to commit crimes and riot, and no one seems to do anything about it. So if you're in a community that you want to save, if the judiciary is against you, if the Democrats who stole the White House are against you, if the money is against you, and if the police won't do their job, well, it makes perfect sense. A bunch of people would show up with AR-15s because they don't want to get killed by the rioters. They want to stop the rioters, put out the fires, do what they can, offer first aid. I mean, this seems entirely logical to me. And yet the prosecutors want to prosecute Kyle Rittenhouse. And how about, and not the perps? Now, here's a question for you. What happened to the perps? Are they being charged for assaulting Kyle Rittenhouse?
Yeah, there was one person who is actually being charged for assaulting Kyle Rittenhouse, yes.
Which one?
I believe his name was Maurice Freeland, because one of my friends was talking to me about it, but let me look it up.
Go ahead.
Also, while I'm doing that.
A lot of times, this is what's so wonderful about Jean. She can look things up, pretty quickly. But I think if you want to look it up real quickly, that's good, too. I think, Jean, are you access to a computer quickly, or are you mostly phone right now?
I mean, yeah, what did you want me to look up?
I think Dave's looking it up now. Whether the people that were prosecuted, the people that persecuted, Kyle Rittenhouse, are they under investigation or arrest for the crime of trying to assault him or trying to kill him based on the testimony that came out in the trial?
No, what I know is that they're still pressing charges on him.
On Kyle or the other people?
On Kyle. The people, like the guy that was shot in the bicep, because he got shot in the bicep. And then the I think probably a wrongful death from the other family members of the other two.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, the fact that he was found not guilty with prejudice, which means they can't bring another criminal case, that's going to stand pretty much in his favor as far as a civil case goes. So really, it'd be interesting to see what lawyers want to take that on. But here's the thing, too. As Dave said in his video, the case really fell apart when the chief violent person, I've forgotten who it was, Rosenberg, I think, or something like that, he said, I pointed my gun at Kyle first.
Yeah,
you said the prosecutor put his head in his hands. Tell me about that, because that's one of the defining moments of the trial.
Yeah, no, I mean that was really when I wasn't really following it actually until I heard about that, just because I busy with school. I knew that Kyle Rittenhouse was innocent just based on a little bit of stuff that I had seen. That's like when I really actually got interested into it. So it's like, okay, so now it's a definite. There's no way they can convict this guy unless they're just purely being political. And then I actually heard that the judge was actually a pretty good guy. So I was like, okay, so that's when I started thinking that, Kyle wasn't going to be convicted of this. But yeah, no, I mean, when your star witness goes against the entire case that you're trying to build up, I mean, you can't win the trial after that.
Well,
and that's what
they
did. Because, I mean, that
if you're a decent prosecutor, you're never supposed to ask a question you don't know the answer to. That's like court trial 101. So the fact that he surprised them with that, was he coached not to? And here's my other question. The reason I asked if he was facing any other charges is because if he's not facing charges for attempted murder or assault or whatever, he was trying to do to Kyle, if he wasn't facing any charges for his actions, then his biggest fear would be perjury, right?
Yeah.
Carries what, seven years or more sometimes? So perjury. So in other words, if he had immunity, or if he wasn't being prosecuted for trying to assault or kill Kyle Rittenhouse, then perjury is his biggest concern. So it's actually to his advantage hugely to tell the truth, even if the truth, ruins the prosecution's case, because that's not his concern. But the witness is first of all, duty-bound to tell the truth anyway. But he would suffer a far greater penalty for committing perjury than for anything he did to Kyle that night.
Yeah.
Right?
Definitely, yeah.
So I'm wondering why he's so honest. Can you think of any other reason why he'd be why someone with that kind of background, who is not known for their honesty, would actually state that in open court, other than a potential perjury conviction? That's the only thing I can think of.
I think that would be what it is, because, the video, I can't think of any other reason, but it makes sense that he doesn't, don't want to commit perjury, so.
Did he get immunity? Did any of those people get immunity for telling the truth?
I don't know.
Huh. Well, because if not, they can be arrested themselves. They just admitted to assault with a deadly weapon, attempted murder. They admitted some really serious charges. You know, some of the charges they wanted to bring on Kyle. That's why I find this so fascinating. Yeah. Okay. Well, tell me about the judge. What do you think of the judge's job?
Well, you know, just what I've heard about the judge is that he was really fair, especially towards Kyle. Like the prosecution would try to get some stuff blocked, and then the judge would say no. Or the judge even yelled at the prosecutor once, and I believe
it's a disaster. But yeah, okay.
Yeah, I mean, the funniest thing that I saw about the prosecutor is I don't know what the context was, but he had an AR-15, and his finger was on the trigger, and he was pointing it at the jury. I guess he was like showing them what weapon Kyle had. And that's how he handled the weapon.
Given what Alec Baldwin just did when he put his finger on the trigger of a gun he thought was unloaded, that actually is technically an assault. That's the very thing that Kyle, got self-defense for when somebody pointed a gun at him with the intent to kill him. So what's the difference? The difference would be this is court and the prosecutor was not trying to kill the jury. I mean, I guess we can assume that. But the thing is, but he actually brandished a weapon with his finger on the trigger and pointed it at jurors, which is a threat to the jury. Is that not in itself a crime that can be prosecuted? What do you think?
I guess not. I mean, he's the prosecutor. So no, I mean, yeah, I don't know. Well, I mean, I do know. Yeah, I mean, you can't just... I guess they just, his intention wasn't to, do that. But
I'm surprised the juror didn't say, Judge, Your Honor, the prosecution's pointing a gun at us with his finger on the trigger. Can you do something about that? I mean, I would have said that. I would immediately, either raise my hand, just shout it out. Excuse me, Judge, the prosecutor's pointing a gun at us. that alone might have declared a mistrial. I mean, I don't know. But I just find that... That in itself is a crime. Okay. I had problems with the judge. The judge seemed, I think he did some things right. I think he definitely was right in kicking an MSNBC out for when the producer followed the jury. But I think he made a mistake in not sequestering the jury. That jury never should have been out of that court case, or they should have been completely cut off from the public until that jury had finished their work. I think that was a huge mistake not to sequester the jury. What do you think?
You mean like to make it so the jury like couldn't look at the news and stuff like that?
Yeah, if they're sequestered, they're basically locked up. They're in the hotel room or they're in a secure place. They have no access to media. They can't use their cell phones. They can't talk to each other. They're basically put up in a hotel room for the night and they don't get to talk to anybody or they can't they're cut off from the world during the time of the trial.
Yeah, I mean,
did you ever see?
No, I agree. Yeah. I mean, for a case like that, you have to, just because of how highly publicized and political it was made out to be. I mean, even if I like the way the jury ruled, and if outside influences, but if, you can't have outside influences influence how the jury rules on a case.
Do you think it should have been televised?
I don't have any problem against that as long as it wouldn't have influenced, how the jury would vote.
Did you ever see the OJ trial?
I have not. I mean, I've seen bits and pieces. I've seen the glove scene before.
Yeah. If the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit. That is brilliant and dangerous. first of all, the fact that the jury believed it. Because you can give me a huge glove, and I'll work it so it doesn't fit me no matter what I do. So the last thing you do, why would you give the evidence to the defendant and say, here, show me that this evidence is wrong. Okay. No problem. Thanks, coach.
Yeah, I think a lot of the reasons why. I mean, yeah, but.
All right.
But Greg,
another thing.
All right, let's get Jane and then come back.
Can you imagine if it wouldn't have been televised? If it wouldn't have been televised, people want to know the truth.
Well, that's a good point.
Look how mainstream media portrayed it, unfortunately. And those people that watch other news, then it's like, oh, it's just conspiracy or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Would it have been worth doing it as a video after the fact, once the verdict is out, or do you think it was more useful to have it day by day? See?
I don't know. I would say the day by day, I don't, you know, we don't need to see that. But I think just for all transparency, that's why I say it was probably for the best.
Yeah. Yeah, I think in this case.
But I don't know if any should ever be televised. I really don't. Because we can't be armchair quarterbacks.
Yeah. I have mixed feelings about it because, like I said, in the O.J. case, the television dominated the court case. I mean, Judge Ito was such a horrendous judge, and the prosecution was so bad that the TV actually served the defense of O.J. It made him look, you know, because Johnny Cochran was so good at what he did. Now, contrast that with this trial, where TV actually made the prosecutors look bad because they totally sucked. You know, well, they sucked in the other case, too. But in this case, it was good because, you know, the defendant not guilty was the correct verdict, whereas in O.J., I think guilty as hell would have been the correct verdict. So that's a different situation. But that's why I say the jury should be sequestered. So if you're going to televise it, you can't have the jury watching the news every night, watching on TV what all the commentators are saying about it. That, to me, is influencing the jury. So if you're going to televise it every day, which actually was kind of interesting, then you shouldn't be able to, if they can sequester the jury, then you can televise it. That to me seems the best of all worlds, so that the jury is not influenced by the rest of the world until after the trial. But of course, they can watch all the TV coverage they want afterwards and catch up on the broadcast during the time, because so much is videoed. All right. We got about 15 minutes left. Do you want to do more on this, or do you have some other issues that have interest for you to talk about?
Well, I just wanted to say one more thing about the Kyle Rittenhouse case, and this actually brings up another. I think this could definitely bring up another interesting conversation, and that is a lot of the stuff that I have seen, especially like my Instagram with even people that I know and stuff, like looking at their Instagram stories, like retweeting, sharing, you know, stuff on their stories, is that the main thing that they're upset about the Kyle Rittenhouse situation is that if Kyle Rittenhouse was, you know, black or Hispanic, he would have, like, gotten shot by the police or something. It's something that, even though there are no police there, and he turned himself into the police. But somehow he would have gotten shot by the police.
Now, if he were black or Hispanic, he wouldn't even gone to trial.
Oh, yeah. Totally. So there's this, I think this is what y'all were talking about before I joined, I could be wrong, but about the, in Texas, the black teenager who, got beat up by some kid or something and then went back in and shot him.
Yeah. Mr.
And so that kid was out on a $75,000, you know, bail. And then Kyle Rittenhouse's was $2 million. And this kid was, it's just so, I mean, talk about white privilege, you know.
Well, no, this kid had black privilege. And this is something we talk about in the show that you're not going to hear anywhere else as far as I know, that we talk about black supremacy and black privilege. You know, the people that are talking about white privilege and white supremacy are invariably, you know, races of a different race other than white. And so this we talk pretty openly about race here. In ways that I don't think you're going to find anywhere, but in terms of this, there is a black supremacy or a black privilege problem in the judiciary right now by the leftists that want to get rid of the police, that want to get rid of bail, that want to have this guy Daryl Brooks, after running over his ex, you know, girlfriend and you know, mother of his kid, got $1,000 bail from John Chisholm, district attorney in Milwaukee. Well, that's insane. That's insanely low. In fact, Chisholm's under investigation for that, for an insanely low illegal bail, he should be under investigation. Mm-hmm. Now the judge, I was watching this last night, I don't know who the judge is, but that was a $5 million bail. So when you think about it, now did Kyle, when he had his $2 million bail, which is pretty excessive, you know, I don't know what the bail guidelines would be, but was he actually able to come up with that, or was he in jail before his trial?
No, Mike Lindell, I believe, paid to get him out.
Oh, that's interesting. Good for Mike.
Now, Mike Lindell paid some money, yes, but there's a whole bunch of people. Ricky Schroeder.
Yeah, but Carl had a GoFundMe.
And then his mom raised a couple million.
Mm.
Yeah, I used to get the emails. I was following the trial along. I was like, well, this is kind of interesting, you know. But, I don't think they could have come up with anything else. But here's something, too. Juries. I want to talk about this for a second. Because whereas we need to analyze, you know, and the use, it's interesting now that I believe there's definitely a black privilege in the judicial system, whereas it used to be just the opposite, where black people, especially black men, got proportionally larger sentences and were convicted more often. So, the proverbial pendulum has swung, it's past the middle ground and gone way to the other side. And so that's a problem when you have like a Simpkin or Simpson, who tried to kill four people, gets out the same day with about $1,000 bail. And someone like a Kyle Rittenhouse, gets $2 million bail, for defending himself. And so he wasn't actually going out to look for anybody. In fact, he tried to avoid conflict as much as possible. Do you know how he got separated from the group? Because that's what really started it.
Do you remember that day? I don't know. So I think he just ended up getting lost, I think. I don't remember, specifically how he got separated. But, yeah, him getting separated is what definitely, led to it happening.
Yeah. And
it wouldn't have happened if he was with his group.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because everybody else, that's the whole thing. If you have a bunch of people with AR-15s, you'd be stupid to attack them. That's the whole point of it. So the AR-15 actually prevents violence, and that's what this is all about.
Yeah.
It's just interesting that the Simpson character down south, the black teenager, openly went out. He brought a gun. He took it out and he shot people. He assaulted people. He murdered people or tried to. I think, did everybody live in that, or did he kill anybody there?
I
think they lived, which is good.
Yeah, I think they did also.
Okay, but the point was, it's still attempted murder. It's the same as a murder charge.
Yes.
Right? But so he's out on a ridiculously low bail, and yet Kyle Rittenhouse, white guy, labeled white supremacist. So the prejudice was already there against him because, the leftist mob wants to demonize anybody who's white, Christian, and male, which includes you and me, as like the enemies of society. I've got an interesting piece I'll probably be doing Friday. On the demonization of similar demonization to folks in the Soviet Union back in the 20s under Stalin, who anybody who was undesirable, who wanted a bit of freedom or a different government, was immediately labeled an enemy of the state and demonized as such, much like Jews in Germany, kind of thing. Now, we're not at a Holocaust level. I'm not trying to equate that much, but I'm talking about the demonization part. Is definitely going on now. That's worth exploring. But I want to talk about that. Yeah, I want to talk about. We got about 9 minutes left. Juries. What do you know of the power of a jury in criminal cases? What comes to mind?
Well, I know that basically. Now I watched a video on this. An idea of I don't know if this is specifically what you're wanting to hear, but the idea of jury nullification. The idea of jury nullification, so that basically a jury, so juries technically can rule like however they want, regardless of, because technically a court can't be wrong, like legally speaking, like you can't say, oh, the court's wrong. Technically, speaking, obviously
no,
it can be wrong, but
you can appeal a decision.
Yeah, sure, but appeals. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But so with the jury nullification, an interesting thing is that if you're selected on the jury, if you tell the attorney that you believe in jury nullification, that they won't pick you to be on the jury. Like they will.
Oh, no, I've been thrown off. In fact, that's exactly how I got thrown off the case. So I can attest to that. Well, let me tell you the story. It's kind of funny, actually. There was a case in California. I was called for jury duty, and it was some ridiculously long case that I couldn't possibly do because I was working for myself at the time, and I couldn't afford it. It was some stupid. It was like a fair market value case, and that was a different one. I think it was a couple of times that I was called for jury duty. Anyway, one time, the judge, there was like 200 of us in like the mass before they divided us up for cases, and the judge says, well, you as jurors, you have the ability to judge the facts in the case, but you can't judge the laws in the case. That's our job here as judges. We we determine the law, and you determine the facts. And I said, excuse me, Your Honor, I raised my hand, right? I said, Your Honor, you're wrong. He says, what? he's looking down at me from this big bench way up high, right? So like, I've just questioned God, Judge God. And he's really upset. He says, stand up. I said, yeah. So I said, what are you talking about? I said, well, as a member of the Fully Informed Jury Association, I knew I was going to get thrown off at that point. I said, it's very clear that juries, the whole point of a jury is to judge the laws in the case. That's how we determine whether the laws are just or not, is to test them in court. That's the common law practice. And I said, that goes back to ancient England. I said, you as a public servant should know that the people are above the government and therefore the jury is above the judge. So yes, of course I'm going to judge the laws. And of course I get a standing ovation, right? And then the judge looks at me and says, you're dismissed. Okay, Your Honor. Sorry. Try to be honest. You know, so that's a true story.
Yeah.
Yeah, but in fact, I had Professor Roger Roots, who's from FIJA, the Fully Informed Jury Association, on the show. I'm going to get him back on. In fact, this would be a good time to get him back on to talk about this case. But jury nullification, juries have to judge the laws. Juries are the most powerful entity in the judicial system, and they have to be because it is juries. See, it's not the Supreme Court that's supposed to rule laws unconstitutional. It's supposed to be juries. And people forget that.
Yeah.
That the jury takes the laws and determines through the cases, the testing of cases, whether the laws are just or not. Now, do juries overrule the laws? No, the law still exists. But what the jury does is they acquit by reason that the law itself is wrong. Perfect example of, in California, if someone carries a concealed weapon, all right, and you get arrested for that, and the judge says, oh, well, I'm sorry, The law says that if you carry a concealed weapon, you go to jail for 5 years, and then instruct the jury. And the jury says no, because the Second Amendment says that you have the right of the people to keep and bear arms can't be touched. And so we say this person is not guilty by reason of the Constitution, that the law itself is wrong, and you couldn't arrest them in the first place on that. And that's jury nullification. That's the proper use of the jury, and that's not really taught enough. In fact, I have a course that has like a Miranda. You ever watch cop shows? You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you. Okay. I have a similar Miranda. I have one of our bills here at Action Radio. In fact, you might be interested in pursuing or even talking about this on one of your YouTubes. One of our bills says the juries will get a mandatory instruction. You have the right to judge the laws as well as the facts in the case. And then I say a couple more things beyond that. But that's basically it. So if we did that, juries would be a lot more empowered. That's one of the biggest flaws of our criminal justice system is that juries don't know their rights. They don't know the William Penn trial. They don't know the judge that tried to starve them for several days to get a predetermined verdict. They don't know any of the history of juries, but jury history is fascinating. Have you looked into it, or what do you think of jury nullification in terms of
not really, but, you know, based on the video that I – you know, watched about it. How you explained it, it definitely does seem like, I mean, an idea that needs to be had. Because, I mean, if you just have unjust laws, and laws are, you know, unjust, and the people know that they're unjust, and it's against, you know, the will of the, you know, the community, you know, against, you know, the conscience of the community, then yeah, they shouldn't have to convict somebody. You know, that.
Well, it's kind of why I create Action Radio so that we write the laws by which we consent to be governed by. And part of that is educating jurors and providing a legal situation so that jurors can do what they're supposed to do. You know, as the people are supreme to the government, jurors are supreme to the judge. I mean, that's the way it works in a free society. That's how a republic works. But you have to inform jurors of their power, otherwise they don't know how to exercise or use it. And I'm not talking about frivolous things like getting their favorite person off OJ because he's a celebrity or because he's black or because he's a football player or for any other reason you want or because you hate the judge or you think the criminal justice system is unfair for whatever reason. That's not a reason for jury nullification. Proper jury nullification says the law that's being applied is unjust, and the only way that jurors can take action against an unjust law is to acquit based on the unjust law, not on the action of the person. Because the person may be guilty according to the law, but if the law itself is unjust, the person cannot be guilty of violating a law that has no right to exist anyway. If that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I'll send you the bill, and we should talk more about this. Yeah. Sure. You need to come on the show more often. It's been too long. You should come on regularly if you can. I don't know how busy your schedule is. We'll talk off the air, but
well,
at least
no. So my school starts at 8 for me, and I ride the bus. So, but on days that I have off, summer break, stuff like that.
We start at 6 in the morning. We start at 6 in the morning.
Yeah. I wake up usually at 5:30.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's okay. I don't care if you're groggy when you call us. Or wait for holidays, or at least try to.
Well,
come
what time? What time do you start the show?
Six.
What time do you start?
Six to nine. Yeah, we got 3 hours now.
Okay. You know, actually, I think I – okay. Yeah. I'll try to
call
it.
I'm happy to have you on every week for half an hour, not for an hour, because, you know, I need – this is like a guest hour, half an hour. But if you have a – and you don't have to take a full half hour because we always have extra stuff. But, yeah, you want to – you know, I'll find a time for you. Because, you know, you're one of our first – and I want to get more younger folks on just because, you know, the more that we can do to you know, present you with freedom and different options to have you think, the more you can tell your friends. So the more your friends listen, that'd be better too. And they're welcome to call in. So I really like to
also,
you
if you could send me the link to this episode, I'll send it to my friends.
Okay. Well, you can always catch it at the main link, which is blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. And quite frankly, you have the link on your Facebook page because I put it there.
Okay.
That picture of the thinker?
Okay.
That's the link. You know, the one where you're in the title? I don't know if you read the title. Title of today's show, Dave Schneier, a young reporter on the Kyle Rittenhouse trial. You got the title, dude.
Oh, okay.
You didn't know that? Look at your Facebook page.
Yeah. No, I didn't. I had no idea.
Gene, what am I going to do with this guy? I promote him. I help him out. I give him an hour on my show, and he doesn't even know his title of the show. What am I going to do? All right. We got a minute left. Gene, do you have another comment in our minute, or should we give it to Dave here?
Do you give it to Dave?
All right. Dave, you got a minute.
Yeah, I mean, I guess just to summarize, you know, I think that, you know, if Kyle Rittenhouse, if it was on the other side, if this was a, you know, some Black Lives Matter person at like a Proud Boys protest and the exact same thing happened, that person wouldn't have been prosecuted for murder. It was a totally politically motivated thing. Kyle had every right to be there to begin with. Nothing that he was even doing there was wrong. Because I've heard some people say that, you know, I mean, technically he's innocent, but he shouldn't have been there. I disagree. I think he should have been there. And, I mean, yeah.
Okay. Sounds good.
I mean, there's no way that the Founding Fathers wouldn't have done the exact same thing that
yeah.
he did.
Yeah. We got to actually we're out of time, so I'm gonna ask you a yes or no question, then we have to go. Was he a political prisoner? Yes or no?
Yes.
Sounds good. Thanks, Dave. Thank you, Gene. We'll talk again soon. I haven't decided on Friday. I may or may not do a show. We covered a lot of ground today that I wanted to do, but we'll see. I'll let everybody know Thursday online on Facebook. Anyway, Greg Pengles for Action Radio at blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction and our legislative website where you can find my judicial Miranda warning and removal of judicial review from the Supreme Court is at www.writeyourlaws.com. That's WRITEYOURLAWS, writeyourlaws.com. And we'll be back either Friday or Monday. I haven't decided yet. Either way, have a happy Thanksgiving, and we will talk to you later.
Happy Thanksgiving.